These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
It was that ant that stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
One ant. Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss. They're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, blast off!
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends. There it is.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
So, hello everybody, welcome to Upside Down World. Mad Science Show. So, I was looking around and checking things out, and I saw this doggone video. Let me see if I can find it. A couple are facing eviction from their Hobbit-style mud hut. Let me repeat that. They're getting kicked out of a mud hut. I guess it ain't funny, but, I mean, come on, man. I can see you maybe getting evicted from a big, nice old house that you got a big giant mortgage on. But a mud hut? Really? I mean, is like the bank going to like turn around and resell it or something like that? Now, I was actually telling these folks, I did post the video down in there if you're interested over there at the Super Chat room. But if you want to be interested in the specifics of it, it's, I don't even know if maybe they put it on the wrong, property where you're not supposed to be or whatever. But either way, I thought it was kind of interesting that somebody would get evicted from a mud hut. Anyway, so you're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html. And while you're on that super chat, if you want, you scroll down there and look underneath the chat rooms. There's four of them down there. You click on that link and go over and visit the People for People radio network. Go see all the people in their chat room, too. Say hi. But, I just want to, start off with some of the boring stuff first and kind of talk about things here a bit. Try to figure out what's going on. all these people out there keep on saying about we got to reduce our carbon footprint. And you always hear these people talking about how, we got all this problem with climate change and we got to fix that. And then you hear people hollering about how the rich people should pay for all the climate change. And, because the poor people are not only getting flooded, but they have to pay too. So, it's beyond ludicrous. Anyway, and so you got all these other people out there that are supposedly, climate activists and stuff like that. And they're supposed to be fixing things up, you hear all these excuses why we can't go to renewables or, why there is no such thing as free energy, all this kind of stuff. So if you can't get to the free energy portion of it, you can't get to the renewable, I guess you got to stick where you're at, because you can burn coal and oil and what they like to call fossil fuels, and then you can there's all kinds of biodiesels, and you could use solar or whatever, and hey, we just keep the status quo and see what happens down the line. They think that, 12 years is, well, it's probably less than that now, but they think 12 years we're all doomed and the world's over and all that kind of stuff. Well, we might as well enjoy the last 12 years and, smoke them if you got them kind of thing. Hey, if it's coming down, it's coming down. And if you can't fix it with renewables, or renewables aren't good enough, then we could all just, we can't burn our houses down, because you'd imagine the carbon footprint that would leave. So you're just going to have to leave all your stuff in your house, maybe take a few things with you or whatever, but whatever you can squeeze up in your mud hut. And so everybody's going to have to build them a mud hut. You can't go back in your other house. You got to just let nature take it back, all right? Nature will finally deteriorate it. Your house will fall in, and then eventually, it'll all get absorbed back into the system, and you're living now in your mud hut. Now, you're not going to be able to have, things that, make candles and stuff like that, so in your mud hut, you want to make you some solar lighting or something that's not going to be environmentally unfriendly or cause you any kind of... We want zero emissions, folks. We want no carbon, nothing. All right? And as far as your cars and all that kind of stuff, well, I suppose we're just going to have to, drive them off into volcanoes and let the, nature just kind of, reforge it back into whatever. That way that we don't have to worry about, cars sitting around rusting and somebody potentially getting, cut with some rusty metal and have to, get tetanus or stuff like that. So we're just going to... What we're going to do is we're just going to have, everybody line up, and we get up to the top of the volcano, and you put it in neutral, and you step out, and you let the thing roll off in there, Even the nice ones, nobody gets to keep their car. And we're going to have to figure out a way. Somebody's going to parachute out of the airplanes, and while these cars are going in one by one in this particular volcano, we'll have all the other airplanes, and And the folks, it'll jump out of the parachute and aim it right into that volcano, so the volcano will melt it all up and absorb it back into nature, and we ain't got this problem anymore. All right, because we got to sort this out, you know, because Al Gore said that there was going to be this thing, and this thing was going to cause a whole lot of water and, you know, flooding and stuff like that. So even Al Gore, you know, hey, he's got to get up out his doggone, you know, whichever house he's in at any given time, because, you know, he owns several houses, and he's going to have to get up out of there and build him a mud hut somewhere on his property. You know, like a mud hut mansion, it kind of thing. And that means he's going to get his hands a little dirty and that kind of stuff. And you're only going to be able to use whatever's fell on the ground as far as, you know, roofing or, you know, some straw or maybe some bamboo or something like that. Whatever's fell on the ground, you're okay to use. If nature's already dropped it out, then, you know, it's not, you're not going to tear up the environment. But no candles up in your mud hut, so you want to maybe try to creepy crawly proof at the thing so that you don't got like bugs crawling on your face during the middle of the night, because it's really not easy to sleep when you got you know, big bugs crawling across your face or that kind of stuff. So maybe you might not want near as many windows in that thing or whatever, you know, to keep the skeeters off your eyebrows and stuff. You're just gonna have to be, look folks, you're gonna have to use common sense. All right. When you build your mud hut, you don't want to build it next to the river, because if the river comes up, you know, it might just wash your mud hut on down the line and stuff like that. Now, you know, and we can get around a few things out there. You know, if the trees already fell down and you got one of them big old giant two-man saws, you and your buddy get out there and you cut some wheels off a log for your rickshaw, and you know, y'all have transportation. Now, granted, one of y'all is going to have to walk, and you're going to take turns. One walks one day and pulls the rickshaw, and the other one, maybe you just like, one day you get up and you pull the rickshaw for your buddy in the morning, and then on the way home from work, your buddy pulls the rickshaw, and then you go back to your mud hut. And so you get this thing sorted out and everything, and you know your carbon footprint and all that's down. And so when it comes down to the you know, grub time and dinner and all that, well, you know, you're gonna have to choke it up a little bit, because you can't be having cows and all those doing all that passing gas and farting and burping and things like that. So you just look, whatever berries you can come across, and there might be some grubs. While you're digging up your mud hut, you might want to store up on some grubs, you know, start your little grub farm and stuff like that. That way you could hold on, man, there's a doggone fly, he's taking up the carbon whatever. I want to see y'all in a nice mud hut, so, you know, if you got an artist friend or something like that, maybe you can get them to come pitch in on that and see if maybe they can, you know, make a design that looks really nice, all right? And so we'll check that out, too. But, old Al Gore, he's going to have some help probably making his mud hut, because he's accustomed to some really nice-looking has shacks and stuff like that, you know, mansion styles. Anyway, I want to start off with some of the boring stuff and work our way through this so we can get it all sorted out, because I want to make sure that, you know, winter time's coming. And you don't want to be up in that mud hut out there in the rain or snow trying to build you a mud hut. In that incident, you might actually have to try to build you an igloo and try to get through the winter, and then when the weather gets better, then start working on your mud hut or something like that. Or just go shack up with somebody, you know, who's already got a mud hut. You know, maybe Al Gore will let you, because he's got a big, he's not going to stay there all the time. He's got three or four houses, you know, and so he could have three or four mud huts. You keep in mind, you can't never go back up in the other one. You got to let nature take it back, because, you know, that's to save the environment thing. You do care about the environment, right? All right, and then these folks out there that are making money off of climate change and global warming and climate disruption and all those other good ones you hear about, they're going to have to, they're going to have to do something different. You know, maybe get out there and start a business building mud huts. And, you know, we're not going to be able to do things like we used to do. So you're going to have to probably try to barter some work and get your mud hut built if you're going to have a contractor come in there and do that, right? So anyway, let's see what's going on here with this deal, because we've got a...
As we can see, these protests today are easily the biggest climate change demonstrations in history. As we heard, this movement is calling for a fundamental remaking of how we power our modern world. I'm joined now by our science correspondent, Miles O'Brien. Miles, walk us through some of the practicalities. If these youth activists are get their way, they would like us to be, by 2030, 100% green, renewable energy. How tough is that?
Well, it's a noble goal, William, but it's a really big stretch to imagine getting there. If you look at the slice of the pie right now that is renewables in the United States, it's about 17%. A little more than 7% of that is hydro dams. There's no new rivers to dam up. A little more than 6% of that is wind. A little more than 1% is solar. In order to get rid of all the fossil fuel production, which is about 63% of the pie, by 2050, one of the big things you have to solve is the issue of storage, the intermittency of wind power and solar. When the sun isn't shining, when the wind isn't blowing, you're not generating electricity. We like to have our lights on 24/7, 365. So that's a big issue that needs to be addressed.
Well, hold on. We got that portion solved, because in the mud hut, you're not going to have a lot of room for refrigerators and TVs and all that kind of stuff. Besides that, you're not going to have any electricity unless you do already have you a solar panel and all that kind of stuff. So the intermittency, you know, just go over to whoever's got the wind turbine across the top of theirs and, you know, have, you know, they used to do like what they call carpooling, where you jump in the car with a couple of your buddies because you're going the same job or whatever, and you save on fuel and that kind of stuff. So what we could do is we could get our communities to have... you know, community night, where we all sit around and watch TV or play charades or, you know, make those little shadow figures on the wall with, you know, whatever light we can muster. You know, maybe I have to put it on a day where there's a full moon, because obviously we're not going to be able to be burning a lot of stuff, because if you start burning stuff... I tried to mention earlier about how we're going to cook our food. We're not going to be able to cook... you know, like we normally do anymore. We're just going to have to be creative. But ain't no more barbecue beef and chicken and steak like that, because we're just going to go back to, I don't know, whatever we can eat, some grubs. You're going to have to, you know, not cook it or whatever. Something like that, you know. Maybe some sushi, some raw fish up at the mighty Mississippi or something like that, you know. Some mud fish or something like that. Anyway, well, I guess worst case scenario, it could eat the roof off your mud hut. Let's just keep on rolling here, because, no, really, we got to be serious about this, folks, because you know what's going on out there. We get that climate change stuff going on, and, you know, we got to get this done by 2030. It's almost, well, we got maybe 11 years, I think.
And it raises questions about, where does nuclear power fit in the mix?
Today, coincidentally, is a rather remarkable day in American U.S. nuclear history, because as we saw, Three Mile Island, the infamous plant in Pennsylvania from that accident that happened in 1979, closed up shop today, permanently shuttered. Can you remind us of what happened back in 79 with Three Mile Island and how that impacted U.S. nuclear policy?
Yeah, it's an interesting coincidence or irony, whatever you like. March of 1979, the Three Mile Island Unit 2, through a combination of mechanical problems and human error, had a partial meltdown. In the end, only a small amount of radiation was released. I think the estimate was people within a 10-mile radius received the equivalent of a chest X-ray after it happened. But it changed the thinking about nuclear in a fundamental way. There was growing concern about nuclear, and interestingly about...
I just got an idea here, you know. I was thinking about this for a second, and I was thinking, like, you know, hey... You need a mud hut. You're not going to be able to drive your car anymore, so maybe you could just, like, park your car somewhere where you like it, get your scenery good, everything, you know, and then start covering it up with mud and just use the car itself, and we can all sleep in our cars, built into mud huts. That way, you know, your neighbors won't see some crazy looking car over there, because we're not going to have cars like we do now. We're going to have you know, like pedal car kind of things like that, because, you know, they got these nifty little toys that kids ride around in, and all you got to do is people power, you know, power these up with your legs, and you eat a lot of berries in the morning, get your carbohydrates and everything, and, you know, just pedal yourself to work and back, and maybe you can even help a brother out and drag a rickshaw behind you. And see what's going on with that. You maybe tie a couple wagons to it so you can kind of carpool with your pedal car and stuff. And I was just thinking about that, but you could actually, you know, hide those cars. That way the green people won't get kind of riled up every time they see, oh no, you can't have a car, you know. And maybe even we could just ground some of them airplanes and cover them up with dirt and mud and stuff like that and make a grass roof on it. You know, this is already nice inside. I mean, if it's already made, you don't have to worry about pulling resources out of the earth in order to do it. So, we can use what we've already got and, you know, just buy, sell, and trade with the old barter system from that point on. Because I think that's always kind of nice whenever you get something that somebody else wants and they got something you want, and then you can trade them and no money involved, and everybody walks away with a smile, and you go back to your mud hut and you show your wife, oh, look what I got here, baby. I got a new wooden spoon. I traded my old car for that. Now you're going to turn that old car into a house. We don't have to worry, but you got a wooden spoon. Now you can stir up some soup, lady, my honey, and stuff, and she probably smack you upside your eyebrow with it, but that's okay, because, you know, it's a little painful when moving over into this kind of thing. You know, we got to work things out. But anyway, let's keep moving on with the boring stuff. He's not talking about nuclear right now. We were not going to have to worry about nuclear either, because we could actually use some of that, maybe make a swimming pool out of it or whatever, you know, but we're just going to, like, repurpose everything, reuse what we've already got, so we don't have to stress over all this kind of stuff. And, you know, we just keep an eye on everybody, make sure everybody's doing what they're supposed to be doing, and they're not, you know, trying to, you know, be out there smoking or drinking bubbly drinks, anything like that. And we can take this one step at a time. We'll sort this thing out. You know, it's only going to take us, what? We can get this done in 12 years. I think that's what or 11 years is what we calculated up a minute ago. Let's see what we can, let's see where what's going here.
3 weeks prior to the Three Mile Island incident, a movie, a very popular one called The China Syndrome, came out, which portrayed an evil corporation cutting corners and leading to a meltdown at a California nuclear power plant. So in this case, life imitated art, and frankly, the public, I think, conflated those two events. Of course, subsequent to that, you had Chernobyl, more recently Fukushima. People get scared about nuclear.
And what did that do as far as our building out of nuclear? Like, how much do we rely on nuclear power today?
Well, right now it's just a little below 20%, but the plants are closing precipitously. We've had, since 2013, 8 of them have come offline. In the next few years, it's projected to be at least another 7. So that 19% piece of the pie that's nuclear is slated to drop to about 12%. Now, of course, what's replacing it? Mostly fracked natural gas, which is on the rise. Renewables are on the rise, too. But a lot of people would say
hold on there. We can't be having no fracking going on. Man, you're going to have to run heavy-duty machineries and diesels and stuff like that. You can't be cracking up the doggone ground. Somebody's mud hut going to end up in a sinkhole. Now, see, I don't understand what all these people's problem is, because, you know, it's plain and simple what we got to do here. We got to go back to, well, I wouldn't necessarily say the Stone Age, because we already know about metal, but we're going to have to recycle the metals we already got. So if you're going to make you a shank or a dagger or a sword or, you know, a butter knife or something like that, you just go out there and find you an old leaf spring off an old car, and you know, you're not going to be able to make you a forge or a fire or anything like that. You're just going to have to use, you know, brute force and pound this thing into whatever shape you want, and hope that the people don't holler about all the noise pollution in the mud hut next to you. I suppose if you make your mud hut thick enough, they're not going to be worrying about all that noise and all that. They might be more preoccupied with the doggone, slithery things that might be crawling up in there, or those things with a whole lot of legs that just come rolling in there looking like a snake, but they got legs on them and stuff. And so, you get you a good old straw broom and you can sweep those things back out the door. That you just take care of things so that you ain't, living in discomfort. You want to make sure that your mud hut is bug-free. You know, there might be a new job there or something like that. If you're not necessarily worried about bugs, you could go over there and be the exterminator at the neighbor's mud hut and say, I'll get that up out of here for a couple berries and stuff, and maybe a potato or two. Yeah, so if it grows in the dirt or falls off the tree, it's good. Everything that you think you're used to doing like that, we're going to have to change a little bit of that in order to make things right, reduce that carbon footprint and halt the global warming, climate change, climate disruption, all that kind of stuff. We got to get this sorted out because we're running out of time, man.
If you want to address this carbon issue, which these young people are all about, you need to keep nuclear in the mix, at least in the short term, because these plants are not being replaced necessarily by zero carbon alternatives.
There are other nuclear proponents, Bill Gates among them, who was in D.C. recently lobbying for billions of dollars to be spent on a new generation of these nuclear plants. What happened with that effort?
It's not easy. The average age of a nuclear plant is 39 years right now in the United States. The technology has kind of been frozen in time. Bill Gates is investing in a technology called TerraPower, which is sodium-cooled, not water-cooled. It has some inherent safety capabilities. The company wanted to build its first plant in China, but at the first of the year, with the trade war that the Trump administration engaged in with that country, those plans were scuttled. There's one other company, NuScale, that is building these small modular water-cooled reactors, and there's a plant that is in stages of being permitted, which would be built in Idaho. That has some inherent safety features as well. A lot of people would tell you that there is a whole new generation of nuclear out there that has many more safety features in it than the current fleet, and it's time now to put some investment in those.
All right, Miles O'Brien, our science correspondent. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, I'm not so sure about all that kind of stuff there about the nuclear power and all that, because that's just not going to jive. And when it comes around to the military, they're going to have to put down the guns. I wouldn't necessarily say put them down. They just don't want to be firing a bunch of bullets around, have all that gunpowder and sulfur in the air and smoking up the joint and all that kind of stuff. So they could, just use them like shillelaghs, or, try to maybe, sword fight with them or something like that. We don't need them running around shooting off those things, so we're going to have to figure out a way to put all that ammunition and bombs and bullets and stuff like that so that nature can take them back, because we're not going to be obviously destroy them in the conventional way. We're going to have to, we just need to stop doing everything we're doing right now, man, and do it differently. Have the mud huts and maybe a mud hole so you can have your friends over for a good swimming day or whatever like that. And, if everybody's wearing a mud wig, then there's nothing about, style or anything like that. You're not going to be out of style, because everybody's going to look kind of, like a little dirty or something like that. But it's okay. We'll sort all this kind of stuff out as we go. We just want to make sure that you ain't driving your car to work no more, and you're not going back into that old house. Maybe you could go in there long enough to get some materials that are already made, because I suppose you could actually use a little wood in your mud hut, as long as it's not new cut or whatever, so you're not deforesting the planet, so to speak. You can just reuse what you already got. And I suppose you could probably live in your old house as long as you want, but might get a little drafty up in there. I don't know. The idea is to let nature take all these houses back so you ain't got to worry about it and, you know, build a mud hut. And that way, if you're living in that mud hut, you're reducing your carbon footprint and you're not wasting all the electricity or anything like that. Imagine if you already got a solar panel, you could hook it up to your mud hut so you can have some lighting that way and let the sun shine down on you or something. And, you know, because once those batteries are gone, we're not going to be able to make any more unless they're environmentally friendly. You could probably get a whole bunch of citrus fruits and stuff like that and make you a, you know, homemade battery out of them and stuff like that. And once you're done with that, then, you know, you just have to try to find you some more, you know, citrus fruits and make you a battery or whatever. Because we're not going to be able to use industry and factories like we used to, because, you know, that's just not going to jive with the whole new Green New Deal. We got to make sure that everybody complies. And, you know, all these folks out here that's used to all these really fancy duds and stuff like that, I don't know about all that, because, you know, it takes some industry going on there in order to make all this kind of stuff. So we're going back a little bit. You know, it's the only way we can save the world from, you know, impending doom, you know. And now Al Gore, you know, hey, everybody's got to pitch in. He can go out there and pick up sticks and stuff like that. Of course, we can't burn them. We might be able to use them for self-defense, but, you know, somebody tries to beat you down and steal your mud hut, you can poke them in the eyeball with one of them sticks or, you know, something like that. But then again, you got a problem there, because ain't going to be no ambulance coming to you to get you. Patch that eyeball up. You're just going to have to carterize it or something, you know, and just kind of hope for the best. You know, these are the things that we got to think about, because these are, you know, when you're talking about reducing down to zero carbon, a lot of things got to go. A lot of things got to go. We got to get back down to caveman style living or something like that, or at least far back to living in a mud hut. But because of the seriousness of the situation, you're not even going to have to be able to have a campfire. We're not going to be able to do that, because they say that pollutes too. So let's keep moving here and see what, you know, we got to do something.
What's the company bracing for? What's the strategy come Monday morning?
So I think everybody is anticipating a repeat of the primaries, where we'll have Fernandez win by a large enough margin to go ahead and declare him finally president, so there won't be a runoff in late November. I think that that's what the market is anticipating. I think that's what polls are showing. I think the energy market is extremely anxious to hear what the energy policy is going to be going forward. Alex, it's really important to understand that Argentina holds the second largest natural gas shale deposit in the world and the fourth largest oil shale deposit in the world. It is currently being explored. It is currently being produced. Many majors.
I really don't know what you can do with natural gas unless you're planning on burning it, you know. And so we got to get away from this burning thing. You know, we can't be burning stuff all the time, because you know what happens if you get a crummy burn, and you get crud and soot and who knows what else up in the air. And we're trying to be soot free. We're trying to get away from asthma and zits and all that kind of stuff. Acne, for those of you who don't know what a zit is. We don't want acne. We don't want, because we're not going to be able to buy acne cream anymore, because that has to come through the industry and stuff like that. But either way, you know, you can use some of that mud, put it on your face, and that'll clean your pores out, you know, dry it out real good, give you a really tight skin and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, a mud mask, you know, there's another business, could be, you could get you a spa together, and whenever somebody comes over there, some beautiful lady or whatever, and she wants to be stay beautiful, and so when you get there, she gets to the spa, you come up there and slap some mud on her face and smooth it out, let it all dry up until it's all crusty, and then whenever it's all done, well, then, you know, all you got to do is just like peel it off, or, you know, dip your head under the water and go like something like that, you know, because that's what you got to do in order to get that mud off your face. And you'll look better for it, and you'll feel better. You know, you ain't got to worry about that course, there is problems where you could potentially get maybe a case of ringworm or, I don't know, some sort of parasite growing on your face if you get the wrong mud. So you're going to have to, you know, really be careful. Maybe use an old Coke bottle or something for a magnifying glass and see if anything's squiggling around in it before you smear it on your face, because you don't want, you know, you don't want that kind of stuff going on. Some sort of big old giant looking nasty old slug on your face or whatever. But, you know, we'll work this out. And so, anyway, let's just keep on rolling.
From around the world are down there, and it is the most important sector for the Argentine economy. Over 50% of investment in Argentina over the last 4 years has been dedicated to the energy sector, and clearly it can help the company's fortunes going forward. It's just a question of how does the government, with its troubles financially, go ahead and incentivize drillers financially to drill.
What would it take for drillers to start drilling again? We have an oil price freeze. That's one thing. You also continue to have an export on oil products and oil to begin with. So what's it going to take for Madalena, for example, to go in and do it?
Madalena is actually drilling as we speak. They haven't pulled back at all in light of the freeze.
Okay.
Yes, their properties are in such full swing, so to say, that it's going ahead. It drills with Pan American Energy, which is an arm or an investment by British Petroleum, and they're going ahead and drilling, and production has upticked. But to your point more broadly, I think it's going to take a clear energy policy and a clear path towards profitability for the majors. I don't think that the country is going to have difficulty doing that. I think it's going to have difficulty in the short term balancing, obviously, the high price relative on a peso basis, the price of gasoline at the pump or the price of electricity in the home vis-a-vis natural gas. But on the other hand, it seems clear to me for the long term, and I think it seems clear to almost any economist in the country that you talk to, that in order to go ahead and increase the good fortunes financially of the country, the energy sector is going to need to succeed. The only way the energy sector succeeds is if it is incentivized to go ahead and invest in the country to produce more oil and natural gas.
So, Harrison, you advise companies. They're going to come to you and say, hey, I want to get into shale. I don't want to get it here in the U.S. Maybe I go to Argentina. What do you say?
I say you better be a pretty healthy, large player to expose yourself to that kind of political risk. And it's just a tough thing. I agree with David. There's a difference in short-term and long-term. But I'm sometimes, at my age, reminded that John Maynard Keynes says, in the long run, we're all dead.
That's pretty bleak. So does that mean that there's nothing that you think? So let's take what David was talking about in terms of this is a very important asset. The policies at some point will come into place. It's just a matter of kind of how quickly. Do you not believe that? Or do you think it's going to be a lot slower than maybe some people think?
I absolutely believe he's correct in that. And this is the way out of the financial mess that in which Argentina finds itself, again. However, killing the golden goose is something that Argentina has historically been very good at.
So does that mean if I'm a company and I come to you, you want to tell me to go to U.S. shale instead, for example, or is that not a good bet either?
I think U.S. shale is a much more certain bet than Argentina. But again, if you're a very large company and have that kind of opportunity, you need to be exposing yourself to opportunities in lots of places. And so Argentina is a great place to do that on a technical basis.
Mm-hmm. So, David, what do you feel like is the right kind of capital that need to come in? Like, all the majors are already in there, like as David was just, that Harrison was just talking about. Is it enough? Like, how much more do you see to scale up?
So, for sure, to your point earlier about the price freeze, right, a lot of majors have scaled back their drilling in the past quarter based on that. They need to know, based for purposes of their own projections, what exactly the policy is going to look like in order to continue to invest. And certainly there have been pronouncements, even by Vista Oil and Gas CEO yesterday on their earnings call said, we're ready, willing, and able to invest more money in Argentina as soon as it becomes clear to us what the path forward looks like. So I do think that it is increased investments by those that are already there. More importantly, Alex, there are lots and lots of global players that are not yet invested in Argentina. The Russians, the Chinese, much of the North.
Well, you know, the path forward is not such, it's not too clear right at the moment. So We're talking about today, we're talking about living in mud huts and rickshaw transportation. Well, you know, you could always go back to as well piggyback rides. You know, the big guy will carry maybe two or three of his buddies to work and that kind of stuff. And whoever's on the dude's back, he'll have to keep like a paper bag over the guy's face so that, you know, none of that CO2 escapes out, you know, when he's breathing hard from going up the hill or even down the hill for that matter. So, you know, every once in a while you might have to release a little bit of CO2 as this poor individual is probably going to start hyperventilating, and you're going to have to try to get, you know, give them some fresh air and then put the bag back over their face and that kind of stuff. So, I don't know, we're going to have to work this out because, you know, when you breathe and exhale, you're going to get some CO2. So somehow or another, we're going to have to build some sort of reverse anti-pollution, anti-CO2 mask so that you can breathe in oxygen, but you can't breathe out CO2. Well, that's going to be a problem because, you know, some of them plants, they're might going to get a little bit skinny. You know, they might not have as much food as they used to have. With all this going on, I don't know if the green people kind of thought this thing out very well, because, you know, if you cut all the CO2, then how you gonna get these plants fed? I mean, I imagine we could probably feed them fish food flakes or cat food or something like that. See if they'll take a liking to that, and maybe the plants will grow. You know, and, you know, maybe put some water on it and that kind of stuff. We should have plenty of water, I would think. And so, as long as we're not CO2 in it, we're all going to have to wear reverse filtration systems on our face so that we're not polluting. Maybe we could build those same types of reversed, you know, pollution kind of masked and things for the cows. That way, we're not really going to need cows anymore. So we're just going to have to let them run free. Actually, just kind of let the animals run free and let them do what they do, that kind of stuff. And when you do catch one, you can put one of these reverse pollution so that if they fart, it'll catch the methane, or if they burp or whatever, you know. And so, I don't know, it's a little bit more difficult, a little bit more technical than we originally thought about this whole mud hut thing, but we're going to try this because we got to make sure the sea levels, you know, don't go up any higher or anything like that. Otherwise, you know, we'll all have to turn back into fishes somehow. Maybe we could, you know, build some frog suits or something like that. Let's finish out what these folks are saying, because, you know, we got to know what the problem is before we can do it. And, you know, hey, you're not going to be able to crack up the ground, so this poor investment thing ain't really going to jive with what we're talking about.
Nordic players as well, eventually they will want to go ahead and invest there too. Do I expect that there will be foreign financial investors that will come running to Argentina? I don't expect that to happen in the near term, maybe in the medium term. I expect mostly strategic players will continue to invest, and those that are not yet there are going to invest going forward.
So Harrison, in the meantime though, there's going to be consolidation here in the U.S. in terms of shale, where it's going to be the big players that are going to probably going to come in and buy the smaller companies. There was an article in the Journal over the weekend that talked about like a new type of bond that basically you own part of a well and its production, and that was the bond that you were going to get. Is that a good investment? Like, how do you look at these?
No, it's not a good investment. It's a bad investment because we're going to mud huts. We're not going to be able to sell that stuff anyway. We're not going to be able to use it. Just leave it in the ground and be all right. I'm just thinking about something. We're going to have to figure out some communications because you're not going to be able to get your news like you used to get your news. Yeah, it takes electricity and it takes, you know, we're going to have to do something about all this. We're going to have to figure out ways to draw, you know, pictures and write things down on, you know, a rock and then have people pass it around so that they can get the news and all that kind of stuff. I suppose it all work out, but, you know, you might have those individuals might try to be funny and change something on the picture to make it the news story not look at what it was when it started. You know, But we'll have to work this out, you know, maybe make multiple copies and send them in every direction, so at least some people might get the news. But you're not going to be able to do this TV thing, and we're going to have to, you know, shove our computers off into the hole somewhere and try to do something, you know, because we can't, yeah. Let's just try to finish this one out here.
New debt financings.
If underwritten correctly, and there's a lot that goes into that, this could provide yield, which is currently lacking in a lot of the financial products that you can buy. So the theoretical ability for oil and gas production to give you a yield is high, but you have to do the underwriting correctly, which requires good reservoir engineering, good hedging, good wells, lots of stuff. Devil's in the details.
Harrison, is funding drying up? Is it dried up, or is it still open for U.S. shale players?
What funding? It is absolutely dried up. The equities have been absolutely punished. The global uncertainty hurts. It's everyone, the industry is in effect probably over-levered quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone's being told to live within cash flow. That's difficult in many cases.
Oh, wow. So, I don't know, that proposes some problems there, but the thing about it is, we're going to have to get everybody to agree to living in a mud hut. That's the only way we're going to solve this problem right here. Let's see what else we got. See, we got to go through these things right here, because this is important. These folks are, you know, all frustrated with each other and arguing, and, you know, we got to get to the answer if everything's going, you know, awry really quick, and we're having the planet heat up and all that kind of stuff. We got to sort it out, and so that's what we're trying to do here today on Mad Science. We're trying to figure out, you know, the best, cheapest, easiest solution so everybody and his brother can actually afford a home and that kind of stuff. So, you know, you get your hands a little dirty and pack some mud and make you some bricks and all that kind of stuff, and, you know, be creative about it and see, you know, almost like having a sand castle building contest. We could have a mud hut building contest as well, and we could have everybody, you know, riding around in rickshaws and you know, bicycles and things like that, things you just don't use. Of course, you're not going to be able to make any new bicycles. Industry is going to have to come to a screeching halt in order to not get the soot and all that kind of stuff. Let's see what else is going on here.
Another look at Glenn Murray's move to Pembina. I'm Brian Lilly with the Rebel Dot Media. There's so much to say about this move of Ontario's now former Minister of the Environment and Climate Change to a very cozy position to lead up the Pembina Institute. I don't really know where to begin. We've talked already about how Pembina is a radical organization, and Glenn Murray is nothing if not a radical. So he's going to fit in there. We could also point to funding that the Ontario government has given over the years, including to reports such as this one, or to grants from the Trillium Foundation, one of them overlapping Murray's time as Environment Minister, a $250,000 grant, another one while he was Minister for $40,000. I'm sure more of that sort of information will continue to come out. We could also talk about how Murray is now saying he gets to continue the work that he always wanted to do. He won't specifically say he wants to fight pipelines, but let's face it, Pembina fights pipelines. They've just come out in joyous celebration at the cancellation of the $36 billion Petronas LNG pipeline that would have created thousands of jobs in British Columbia. They absolutely don't want resource development. But here's the thing that really gets me. Look at the bottom. Look at the bottom of this article that was published by National Post on how Glenn Murray is going to handle his job. He's currently in Toronto. Pembina Institute is in Calgary. So what's the man going to do? Well, like any good greenie, he's going to fly across the country over and over again. This statement: Murray will maintain his home in Toronto, but will divide his time between Pembina's offices in Toronto, Edmonton, Calgary, and Vancouver. That's one hell of a carbon footprint, isn't it, Glenn? It's kind of another example of him joining the elite set that says, do as I say, not as I do. You're...
Yeah, see, that's the thing about the whole elites thing. There ain't going to be no more elites anymore because they're not going to be able to, you know, fly around in jets and nothing like that. Everything's going to be grounded. The cars are going to be come to a halt, and you're just going to have to probably stay in your local general vicinity unless you feel like walking a long ways, because there's a, you know, a lot of travel to be done. The world's a pretty big place, and if you want to get there, you can't necessarily take, you know, anything that, unless you got a good electric car that might actually be, you know, something that's good or something that's going to last for a little bit. Maybe already got solar connected to it. We're going to have to use what we got to the best of our ability and, you know, try not to have to dig up any more resources or anything like that. So, you know, I don't know. We're just trying to work this thing out here and see how it plays out, because, you know, we got to reduce that carbon thing, you know. So that's why we're trying to do what we're doing here. Ah. All right, let's see what else this guy's got to say.
Vacation to Cancun? You shouldn't do that. That's a carbon footprint vacation that just can't be justified. You should vacation close to home, as long as you don't drive and only take public transit. But him? Well, he can fly across the country over and over again. Brings me to mind of the challenge put out by conservative MP Bob Zimmer the other day. Zimmer is fed up seeing people like Vancouver's Mayor Gregor Robertson, Green Party leader Elizabeth May, and David Suzuki get on planes with him as he flies back to his riding. He goes from Ottawa to Vancouver, and they're always on the planes with him. But they object to having natural resources used in any sort of way. So he issued this challenge to them.
So I'm challenging those three individuals who are leaders in our community, in our province, to stop the hypocrisy. And I'm going to challenge them. There's really two responses that I'm looking for. I'd either challenge them today to either stop using natural resource products like oil and gas, period. So that means no use of oil, no use of gas in any shape or form. So when they go to their house and they go to turn on the furnace in the wintertime, that can't happen because natural gas is what causes their houses to be heated. Oil products is another one again. Like I said, you can't fly anymore. You can't use your automobile to drive around in the streets. You can't buy something that's synthetic. You can't use glass in your house. You can't use all those products that are from oil and gas.
I like the challenge, either put up or shut up. Stop complaining about these natural resources from oil and gas, or stop using them. That's the challenge that should be put to Glenn.
Yeah, and that's what I've been trying to say all along. You know, all these people out there, they jump in these buses and they go to these climate protests and all that kind of stuff. Y'all need to just start walking, man. And woman, you need to walk to, or whatever your gender is these days. It doesn't matter. Just, you know, everybody take the Soul Food Express and make sure you take a vapor bag with you so that you're not, when you get a little tired or, you know, not breathing out no CO2, you're going to have to capture that in a bag and figure out how to do that. You know, maybe put on some, like I say, some reverse filtration system that'll catch the CO2 out of your mouth and that kind of stuff. And so we'll all be running around with basically the equivalence of what looks like a gas mask so that we can get fresh oxygen for a while anyway, until the plants all die off, because they ain't got no carbon to turn into sugar. So we're going to have to figure this thing out. And once we get this all figured out, you know, we might look a little funny and maybe a little dirty because we're living in mud huts. And, you know, but you can go down to your local stream and stuff like that and take a dip and, you know, wash off some of that mud and, you know, that kind of thing there. And, you know, just think of all the fun we can have. We could have mud fights and eat mud pies and stuff. And we'll get it all sorted out. It's only a matter of time. We just got to keep on thinking, and you know, this guy's right. These folks are hypocritical, and they make a lot of money. I mean, I want somebody to see if you can find a list of who's made the most money on the whole climate change or global warming or climate disruption. There's so many different names of that. Anyway, even to the extent of either suppressing free energy or even suppressing renewable energies or complaining about any different types of energies that we've already got or whatever. Either way, somebody's making money about it. These folks are up there fighting against pipelines and fighting against using resources. So we're going to have to stop using resources altogether, but we got to do this as a team. You know, we got to have Al Gore and all the senators and the congressmen and all that, you know, that we're just not going to be upkeeping anything anymore and all that kind of stuff. We're just going to start living in mud huts, and when we have meetings, we'll gather around, you know, something that looks like a campfire, but we're not going to be burning wood, so we're just going to have to try to, you know, get in there, huddle up real good and stay warm and that kind of stuff, and just take it from there.
Murray. But whether it's David Suzuki or Glenn Murray or Al Gore or any of these guys, you know that they're only in it for the money. They're not actually in it to change how things are done. They're in it for their own self-enrichment. Al Gore is about to release an Inconvenient Truth, the sequel, and guess what? He's going to be flying around the world telling you all about it. Remember, this is the guy that told us we would have no Arctic sea ice in the summer by about 2014. He made that prediction in 2009. It's 2017. It's still there, and he's still flying around the world warning us about it. That's what Glenn Murray's about to become. Another self-important hypocrite that will live in Toronto, fly to Calgary, fly to Edmonton, fly to Vancouver, and tell the rest of us how to live smaller lives. Just another cog in the green money machine.
Yep, that's it. The green money
if you like
machine.
The Rebel video.
But don't worry, because we're all going to be living in mud huts, and we're going to sort this thing out. And, you know, old Al Gore, like I said, he's got to do his part, and everybody's just going to have to, you know, take what they can get that's already made. And from that point on, no electricity. I suppose, like I said, you can still live in the mansion, just can't use the lights and, you know, natural gas or anything like that. And we're just going to basically do the best we can and get out and, you know, there's a website while we still have access to the internet. Go to eattheweeds.com. That'll let you know what you can eat that's around, because you don't want to just go eat anything that you see out there. When you become a vegetarian, you better know what you're eating if you're going out there in the jungle, because you don't want to eat something that's going to give you a rash or worse. Anyway, let's check some more of this stuff out here.
Practice what you preach. It's an admonition that we've all heard sometime in our lives when we're acting like hypocrites. It makes me wonder if Al Gore's parents ever scolded him for preaching one thing while doing another. This question came to mind after the release of Gore's follow-up to An Inconvenient Truth. You see, after the original movie came out in 2006, Gore was lambasted for being a hypocrite. While Gore was predicting climate doom because we are all using too much energy, his own electric bills proved he was burning 20 times more electricity than the average American household. There's nothing more destructive to a crusader's cause than hypocrisy. So Gore jumped into action. He put 33 280-watt solar panels on his roof and, among other improvements, installed geothermal. It seemed he was serious because he spent $250,000 on the renovation. Well, that's the way it seemed anyway. To coincide with the release of Gore's sequel, the National Center for Public Policy Research conducted a new study to see if Gore had stopped being a hypocrite. Guess what? 10 years later, Al Gore is an even bigger energy hog. Gore is burning up not 20, but 34 times the electricity than the national average. The National Center discovered that from August 2016 through July 2017, Gore spent almost, get this, $22,000 on electricity bills for his posh Nashville home. Gore uses so much electricity, all those solar panels provide less than 6% of his power consumption. And by the way, Gore owns at least two other large homes, and they were not included in this analysis. Some folks want to give Gore a pass because his home is huge, more than 10,000 square feet, but that argument doesn't hold up. Efficient homes use between 5 and 10 kilowatt hours of electricity per square foot each year, no matter how large or small. Gore's home, uses 23. Doesn't it make you wonder what the heck is going on in there? Gore divorced his wife Tipper several years back, and she lives in her own mansion in California. And Gore travels a lot, so the home is presumably empty a good percentage of the time. What's got that electric meter running so hard? But it's great fun pointing out Gore's astonishing hypocrisy. There's a more important point to be made here. Gore had to know his electricity bills would be scrutinized when the new film came out. Yet, he became an even bigger energy hog. What the former vice president's actions tell us is that it's more important for him to live the life of an energy-guzzling fat cat than it is to be a crusader who lives modestly so he actually has some credibility. Finally, and this is the most important fact of all, when Al Gore's term as vice president ended, he was worth about $2 million. He then focused all his attention on becoming the world's chief climate change alarmist. It was an extremely lucrative career move. He's now estimated to be worth $300 million. So ask yourself, what's driving Al Gore? Is it really a sincere concern for the planet? Or is sounding the alarm about climate change a great way to get rich? Power on, America.
So, you know, with that last part said, we might be looking at this all wrong here. Maybe we all need to run out there and tell everybody about climate change and gather up some money, you know. Al Gore seemed to do pretty good. We could all sit down and write a book together, and we could tell everybody how terrible it is because climate change, and we could throw in some scary facts and try to make everybody nervous, and they'll want to buy the book. It's all exciting and everything like that. And then maybe we could buy us a mansion or something. You know, but of course, keep in mind, we're not going to be able to use electricity or natural gas or any kind of fossil fuel stuff that we're going to have Flintstone cars or bicycles or rickshaws or, you know, some pedal car or something like that in order to be able to get to and fro, unless we just, you know, work on our jogging skills. We could, you know, jog back and forth. But the problem, we still have the problem of how to not exhale, because when you exhale, you drop that CO2 out there. And, you know, you got to get to that zero carbon emission thing. And so I'm just wondering, have these folks actually really sat down and thought about this? How you're going to do this kind of thing? You know, how you going to get all these people to stop breathing so much in order to, well, the only thing I can think about is reverse gas mask or something like that, something to catch the pollution out of your face so that it's not, you know, causing the planet to heat up. Because surely with everybody riding bicycles and rickshaws and, you know, that kind of stuff, maybe even going horseback, but of course you're going to have to put a cork on the horse so the case cork don't, in case the, your horse don't pass some gas out there and make the problem worse or whatever. Yeah, we're just going to have to figure this thing out here. Let's see what we got going on here.
What really matters is energy in, energy out. If we ate those crops directly, you'd get 9 calories instead of 1 calorie if you funnel those crops through a chicken. So that means 9 times as much land, 9 times as much water, 9 times as much pesticide and herbicide, 9 times as much fossil fuel to power the combines. And then you're growing all of those crops. You're shipping those crops to a feed mill, you're operating the feed mill, you're shipping the feed to the farm, you're operating the farm, you're shipping the animals to the slaughterhouse, you're operating the slaughterhouse. Just a vastly inefficient system. The 9 in, 1 out is vastly inefficient. And then you total all of the inefficiencies, all of the extra stages of production, all of the gas guzzling, pollution spewing vehicles, all of the extra factories. And what you find is that a conservative estimate is that about 13.5%, according to the United Nations, about 13.5% of all climate change is attributable to the meat industry. It's mm-hmm. more than all transportation combined.
And that's a conservative estimate from what I understand, right? I think in Cowspiracy they said it was 15%. I think it depends on how you run the numbers. But 13.5 is pretty, you know, that's being conservative, and it's still Trump's transportation, which is what we're all focused on.
Yeah, I mean, and food waste, which people are focused on. I mean, food waste is 40% of everything we grow we throw away, and obviously that's bad, but this is literally 800% food waste.
Right.
So literally you're throwing away 8 calories for every calorie that you consume, and then you're stacking on top of this that all of these extra factories, all of these other 18-wheelers driving around moving stuff, and I mean, it just, environmentally, the United Nations said no matter what environmental issue you're looking at, from the smallest and most local to the largest and most global, so it's loss of biodiversity, it's water pollution, it's water use, it's soil desertification, it's chopping down the rainforest, every single issue, the meat industry is one of the top 2 or 3 global causes of that issue, including climate change. And on a per calorie basis, somebody sits down and they eat chicken, which is the least climate change inducing meat, that's 4,000% of the climate change as if you were eating legumes like soy or peas. 40 times as much on a per calorie basis for that meal.
Yeah, it's so, total insanity.
It is total insanity.
And what does it look like with beef?
Well, it's even worse. It's about 25 calories in to get 1 calorie back out. So it's, you know, 2,400%. It's as though you're throwing away 24 calories for every calorie that you consume. I don't remember, 330 times on a per calorie basis. I pulled that out of the recesses of my brain. It's a Lancet article from, I think, 2015. But 330 times as much climate change per calorie of protein for beef as opposed for for legumes like soy and oats. Not oats, soy and peas.
So the UN report, that was 2008?
It was, yeah. The 18% one. In 2008, they said 18%, and then I think in 2013 or 2014, they said 13.5.
Right, and then there was this Chatham House report as well, right? A couple of years later?
Well, there's a World Watch report that was put together. Chatham House had a really interesting report. Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which is the foremost think tank in Europe, and they released a report that said unless animal product consumption goes down, no country is going to be able to keep climate change under 2 degrees Celsius by 2050, which is the Paris Climate Agreement. That is the Paris Climate Agreement.
Yes.
No country can do it unless their meat consumption goes down, and they recommended that we educate populations about this issue. And then World Watch did a report from a World Bank agricultural economist and an IFC International Finance Corporation agricultural economist, in which they basically disputed the UN numbers, and they said actually climate change, more than 50% of it is attributable to animal agriculture, and that's pretty easy to find.
Wow.
If you just Google World Watch Institute, climate change, World Bank, it'll be like the first thing to pop up. We tend to focus on the 13.5 because it's still more than transportation. It's still awful, and certainly should be motivating to people.
Yeah, it's shocking. It's shocking that we're not talking about this more. Like, what are the barriers to really being able to penetrate mainstream awareness to elevate this discussion to the highest level? And really, you know, I know you're doing everything you can at GFI, but what do you see as the biggest impediments or the challenges that you face in trying to get people to really understand this and make change?
Well, Rich, we're not actually trying to get people to understand this and make change. Like, GFI's theory of change is that we have beat our head against a wall of education for decades. We have attempted to convince people to change their diets. We've educated people about climate. We've educated them about the inefficiency. I mean, Frances Moore LePay wrote the book that turned me vegan more than 30 years ago. She wrote it almost 50 years ago now, and it makes the arguments that we're making now about the environmental impact and the inefficiency. PETA's been around since 1980, telling people about the harm to animals. Environmental groups have been talking about the inefficiency. Cowspiracy, What the Health, phenomenal films. And yet in 2017, per capita meat consumption in the U.S. was the highest it's ever been in U.S. history. 2018 is going to be even higher. So, I mean, GFI...
Is that theory, U.S. or global?
It's both. It's both. It's skyrocketing globally,
yes.
But it's up in the U.S. Highest it's ever been. I mean, people are generally pretty shocked by that. Sometimes people even say, well, is that because the population's bigger? And I have to say, per capita,
right.
2017, highest it's ever
it's
been.
It's interesting that that is in tandem with the growing, market of plant-based foods and plant-based meats.
It is, yeah. No, it's super interesting. And I think we will see this turn as we give people what they want, but produced in a different way. So the theory of change of Impossible Foods, of Beyond Meat, of Just, of these companies, the theory of change is let's actually give people everything that they like about meat and dairy and eggs, except let's make it less expensive, and so it will sell more, and let's just replace it, because every single survey that's ever been done indicates that what people make their dietary decisions on the mm-hmm. basis of, it's price, it's taste, it's convenience. A lot of us who are having these conversations are like, well, we shop at the farmer's market, or we shop at Whole Foods, or we shop at our local co-op, which my wife and I do in all three cases. And we get this vision of people who are very mindful about the food that they're eating, but even watch what people are eating at Whole Foods. Like, that entire sector is less than 2%. So 98% is Albertsons and Target and Whole Foods, I mean, and Walmart and sort of that sort of grocery, like really big grocery.
Yeah.
But even go watch what people are eating at Whole Foods. I mean, even folks at Whole Foods, it's like the price matters and the taste matters, and whether it's healthy for them is not that high on the scale, which is why obesity rates, they actually, these maps that are sort of color-coded for obesity, they have to keep adding new colors because people are getting fatter and fatter and fatter and fatter.
So you at GFI, you're like, all right, forget about like trying to educate people. That's a non-starter. Like, we're making, for the amount of, like, you use the 9 calories in, 1 calorie out, it's like, you know, 1,000 calories into trying to get people to change their habits versus what you're getting out. So instead, you have this focus on trying to leverage basically market forces to incentivize companies to innovate and to create products that people like that address these problems.
Yeah, no, it's markets and food technology, and that will be the transformation. And we do talk about, you know, how do we feed 9.7 billion people by 2050? We talk in sort of an uber way about keeping antibiotics working because governments care about those things, and we want governments to be supporting research and development in plant-based meat and clean meat. That's a big part of what our policy department does. It's a big part of what our international engagement folks are doing in India and Israel and China and Singapore and Brazil, which mm-hmm. is the areas where we're particularly active. And governments, you know, these plant-based meat and clean meat, they're the solution. They are how governments meet their obligations under the Paris Climate Agreement. They're how governments provide safe food. Food safety is a big issue, especially in places like China and India. They're how water is conserved. They're how resources are conserved. So we talk about these things, but we talk about them to people who are doing policy. So fund these things, roll out the regulatory red carpet for clean meat. If you are a philanthropist or an impact investor and what you care about is climate change or sustainability or global health, these are things that you should be investing in. If you're a foundation and you do grant making in these areas, you should be doing grant making on these issues. Mm-hmm. But for individual consumers, it's really go try the Impossible Burger. It tastes incredibly awesome. And then you can also talk about the impact on the climate or the impact on sustainability or whatever once people are, you know, already thinking, oh, this is like an awesome new food at this hot new restaurant. It tastes amazing. Oh, and I can also feel good about the fact that I'm doing something awesome for the planet, or it's healthier or whatever else.
Nice. All right, so we got to change our diet. We got to not buy things that had to have trucks that moved them around. Not buy things that had to have tractors. So we got to get back to a more natural version of farming. So get out there with your old-style farmer tools and start growing vegetables in your garden. Just make sure you don't use anything that keeps the bugs off of them. You know, bugs got to eat too. And so, you know, with that said, man, we got our work cut out for us. It's going to be different. Stephen Gibbons said they benefit from climate change way they do now. They are the major shareholders in companies that profit from renewables, etc. They also profit from all the countries paying to offset their carbon footprint. See, that carbon offset, that's like if you want to make more crud or soot or smoke, you can trade some of your carbon credits so that you can get by with that, and that's supposed to you know, help it out. It's supposed to make you not want to make you know, soot, but if you do, you got to pay it a little bit extra or whatever, but somebody's getting that money and it ain't you. Anyway, he also said they also profit as this whole issue holds humanity back, restricting growth and equality. So that means the people in like third world countries, they don't get to start building factories and you know, have an industrial age of their own and try to benefit from all their natural resources and stuff. Instead, you know, you gotta like restrict them, and meanwhile, business as usual over here. Everybody does what they do, and of course, you know, we can't just jump all off into solar or wind because they're all about that and energy storage and such. I don't think that any of them even listened to the Mad Science Show, because if they'd listened to me a long time ago, we probably would have already had things sorted out. You wouldn't be hollering about this climate change thing. Ain't nobody from any environmentalist group talking to people like myself that are saying, hey, look, there's a solution. Instead of driving that car the way it is, why don't you do a little bit of re-engineering and make that thing incredibly efficient? Of course, then you got to fight with industry in order to do that, because the industry don't want it to be incredibly efficient, because they want to sell you some of that dinosaur fuel. That's all about. Just like the health industry don't want to cure your common cold because they want to sell you cold medicine. Everybody all falls down to the finance of the thing. Government's getting a lot of money, but what's the government doing with a lot of money? They're basically trying to get more money out of you, charging you a carbon tax. That whole doggone thing's a sham. It's been a sham. So we gotta go back to living in mud huts, and we gotta eat berries and tree bark and grubs out of the dirt, and do things naturally, you know. So, you know, no more AC, no more heating and cooling, all that kind of stuff is out the window. No more refrigeration, gotta get rid of that too. You don't have to go back to making root cellars and putting all your food down there and hope for the best. And, you know, of course, it's only going to be vegetables you're putting down there or anything until, you know, society finally decides that the vegetables, you're going to hurt their feelings if you eat a salad. You know, so you got to be politically correct and just maybe go on a diet, don't eat nothing, you know. I don't know how that's going to work out unless, because if you eat that grub was alive too, so you might hurt that grub's feelings. I don't know. See, we got to think things through. I don't think these folks have actually have a well thought out plan. They got all these ideas, and they start all these foundations, and they do all this other kind of craziness. And you know, they just we're still going around in circles, man. Look how long Al Gore said that sea level was going to rise. We're still, you know, prediction after prediction not coming true. But he's still making money off of it. He went from, you know, a little bit of money to a whole heck of a lot of money, so he's pretty wealthy. He still gets to fly around on the jets and all that kind of stuff, tell everybody, you know, reduce your carbon footprint. So there is a, you know, smidge of hypocrisy going on out there, and the governments and the companies and corporations, they're not going to do much about it. But it's not just that. It's the average Joe, pretty much, you know, going out there buying all these products that it took a tractor trailer to get to the store. It took machinery and industry in order to get things to different places. And they say that, you know, people are starting to live longer because, you know, of medicine and industry and all that kind of stuff, that, you know, now we got things that we didn't have. So we're just going to have to, you know, we're going to have to self-censor and self, you know, move ourselves back towards learning how to do things with natural resources that, you know, like if a stick falls off the tree, it's yours, you know, you can use it. You can't just cut the tree down to get the stick, but, you know, you gather up enough sticks and you can use those sticks to build, maybe instead of, you don't like a mud hut, maybe you can build a house out of sticks, you know, just something like that. And, you know, leaves fall off, and you can make you a nice little bed to lay down in with that, and just stay warm, you know, laying in your stick house with the leaf bed and that. And, well, you know, we can live in harmony with the bugs as well. It doesn't matter, you know, if you park your house on an ant nest and they decide to crawl on your face, then you might kind of be like, you know, their meal or something, you know, depending on what type of ants they got. They might just try to, like, you know, drag you down the hole. And, you know, hey, I guess that's a solved problem there. You won't be, you know, CO2ing it on anybody. And so we'll just kind of, we'll do that. And when the ants and the bugs and the spiders move up into your mud hut, just give them a good old handshake and a smile and say, oh, you know, hey, welcome, my friend. You know, you're part of nature, and so you're my friend, and it's okay. You can sleep in my hair and stay warm. And, you know, just try not to crawl on my face too much because it might make me sneeze or whatever, and I don't want you to get hurt and that kind of stuff. And, you know, hey, live in perfect harmony with the fleas and the roaches and the skeeters and the doggone, you know, tarantulas and the slithery snakes and all that kind of jazz. Everybody's all snuggled up in there in one little mud hut together. All you bugs and all whatever animals, just leave the door open, man. That way the raccoons and the squirrels and all that can come in there and they can join you in your endeavor to reduce your carbon footprint. So once we get that all accomplished and all your neighbors are living in mud huts, we'll all have fresh air to breathe and, you know, that kind of stuff. It's just, you know, we got to do this because they said that we only got, 12 years, maybe slightly less now, and we got to make sure we get this sorted out. You know, we don't want to, like, have the planet catch on fire or, you know, the polar bears not having a good foothold on the ice and stuff like that. We got to make sure that everything is everything, you know. And we're going to have to start talking to all these animals out here and say, you know, look, you're going to have to stop munching on each other, that kind of stuff. And we're going to get, you know, gas mask on each one of them. Now, if you put a gas mask on a fish, I wonder, does that change anything about their navigation or the way they breathe or something like that? I don't know. We're going to have to figure it out, though, because this whole climate emergency slash global warming slash climate change thing, it's going to have devastating consequences if we don't get our act together. We got to move up into these mud huts and ride rickshaws and keep paper bags over our face so that we're not breathing too heavy, you know. And you can watch for the warning signs. If somebody looks like they're getting ready to hyperventilate and pass out, you can take the bag off their face. But in the meantime, you got to capture as much as that possible. I don't know if you can actually get down to a complete zero of CO2 release, but we're going to have to do the best we can in order to save humanity. You know, because we're all running around with mud wigs and you know, straw kind of you know, clothing and stuff. These things, you can make a shirt out of some old sticks, you know, some twine. Get you some old grapevine or something like that, twist it around, make you some boxer shorts and that kind of stuff. And you know, use some leaves for some padding. You know, we could do this thing. And heck, you know, there's some people that's into body painting and stuff like that. Maybe you don't wear no clothes. Maybe just covered up in mud. You know, just make you some mud pants and a mud shirt. And, you know, around Halloween, you could make you a mud mask and go out there and do the old spooky thing and go trick-or-treating and get some berries from people and maybe some sticks and, who knows, some rocks or something like that. Yeah, we could get this and we could still keep all our holidays and stuff and be able to, you know, live like that. We're just going to have to not have the things that we have now because, you know, how they're causing all this this chaos and stuff. I'm just trying to figure all this stuff out so that you don't have to, and we can get everybody on board and you know, living in a mud hut and riding rickshaws and bicycles and things. You know, anything that's already made, don't worry about it. It's okay to use it. Just we can't make any new stuff. So it might get a little old and that kind of stuff. You're not wanting to spray all kinds of greases and oils on your bearings and stuff like that, because you wouldn't want to have anybody go out there and start drilling for oil again. That just started all over and we'd be in a mess. So anyway, I'm thinking we'll take a quick music break here and try to get my brain sorted out, and I might even get the pencil out and draw me up some doggone mud hut and see what I can build and take it from there. What do you think? All right, stay tuned. You're listening to Mad Science.
Says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a gold grind. interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see, a woman and the kids and the dogs and me. Got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve us out and you can't make us run, cause when them old boys raise their own shotgun, from the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies. And we can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway night, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, cause the country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. And we can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
crickets are singing and lightning bugs are floating on the breeze. Baby, get ready. Across the field where the creek turns back by the old stumble road, I'm gonna take you to a special place that nobody knows. Baby, get ready. Summer's come and the days are getting long. Waited all winter for the time to be right just to take you along. Baby, get ready. And it don't matter if we sit forever and the fish don't bite. We'll jump in a river and cool ourselves from the heat of the night.
That stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Ooh.
One ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss. They're puny.
Hmm, puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends. There it is.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Okay, and we're back, and we're just going to keep on moving right along and see what kind of common sense we come out of this.
Let me show you the world. When I was a student, there was 1 billion people in the West, the rich part of the world, and there were 2 billion people, each block 1 billion, in the developing world, and there was a gap in between. What has happened during my lifetime is that we became 4 billion more in the world, and the richest became even more rich. Where have these extra ended up? With 1 billion is actually where the West used to be, like successful China, Brazil, Turkey. They acquired the Volvo company, so we know that they are just back of us. And 3 billions are here. They have a relatively decent life. They're 2-child families. Children go to school, but they live under modest economic situation. 2 billion are almost as poor today. 1 or 2 billion, as it was before. The poor are a smaller proportion of the world population, but their numbers is almost the same. Now, if I would place them in a sequence, the very poorest 2 billion, these billions, imagine the 7 billion people in the world from the poorest to the richest. And we have 7 million children who die every year. 7 billion people, 7 million children die. 6 of these die in the poorest 2 billion. 1 die here in the middle, and here almost no one. Where are then the fossil fuel emission? If this is all the carbon dioxide emission in the world, almost half of it has been here now the last decade with the richest 1 billion. There are 2 units here. There is 1 unit each here and only 1 unit for these 2. It's very unevenly distributed into this direction. They really emit a lot of carbon dioxide. And these ones are getting so rich, so they are starting to emit more and more. So what we see now is that we see an addition here because they copy what the richest do. This is the problem of carbon dioxide. The people here in the middle, they hardly doesn't emit anything at all. They just have a lamp in their house. And the poorest, almost nothing. But the challenge for the world now is get away extreme poverty here and get these people to adapt and use less fossil fuel and use more green energy sources so that everyone can share their energy level in the future, because there will be 3 billion more. Then population growth will stop. And this one will get richer. They will move up here. They will come on top. This is how the world will look by the end of this century. And the rich, see here, this is the old Western world. It will just be the foundation of the modern world. And they are very few. They will be less than 10% of the world population. So their fossil fuel consumption, their carbon dioxide emission, has to be on a level that can be shared by 10 times as many people.
Alright, so that hurt my brain. But, you know, they're trying to, like, say the rich folks is the one doing all of it. And they're probably right, because the rich folks can afford the corporate jets and the stretch limousines and, you know, all that kind of stuff, while everybody else is taking public transit or the Soul Food Express, you know, walking around in your old flip-flops till you have a blowout. But, you know, hey, We gotta figure this thing out, right? So let's keep on rolling here.
July 2016 was the hottest July ever recorded. Same with June. And also May. April, though. April was also the hottest April. In fact, every month going back to October 2015 has been the hottest since 1880. Cue the Nelly.
It's getting hot in here.
It's hard to argue Earth isn't heating up, because unless you have a neck problem, it is.
Now,
but what's really warm...
Unless you're standing in my neighborhood where it's like 40 degrees Fahrenheit outside, well, I don't know what that'd be in Celsius, but it's cold outside. It's dang cold outside. We're going into winter time. They always try to talk about how the planet's heating up. Oh, yo, show me, brother. Show me some of that heat. You can hear that noise in the background. That's my electric heater. I got a big carbon footprint because I got a bunch of electric heaters just trying to keep the whole house warm with everybody in it. You know what I'm saying? So, well, I'm not going to be able to do that when I get to my mud hut. We're just going to have to, you know, snuggle or something. Huddle up. Alright, let's keep on going. This is going to get better, I'm sure.
Warming the Earth. The climate's a complex system influenced by everything from our orbit to gases in our atmosphere to volcanoes. And when we say warmer compared to what? For most of history, temperature records look something like this. Hot today, hotter than yesterday, gonna be hot tomorrow. But with the development of accurate thermometers and standardized temperature scales in the 1700s, we could finally get some real data from ships crossing the ocean, weather stations around the world, hashtag colonialism. But weather isn't climate, and a few temperature records do not a complete global climate history make. It wasn't until the mid-19th century that we were collecting enough data in enough places to figure out an average temperature for the whole world, which is why U.S. climate graphs start here, while the U.K. goes back to here. Should we believe what Ben Franklin or Thomas Jefferson wrote in their weather journal? Can we really trust all those old records? These are good questions, but climate scientists have looked at the data through many different lenses, and every time they do the math, they get the same answer. Earth is warming up fast. But none of this explains the cause. It could be human activity, but it could also be so many other things. Earth's orbit is pretty wobbly. Our elliptical path around the sun spins like a hula hoop. Earth's axis draws a circle every 21,000 years and wobbles back and forth every 41,000. And all of these affect Earth's climate. But scientists understand these changes really well, and when they use...
Well, I'd like to understand, if scientists like got all this data and stuff, how do they know what the weather was like 41,000 years ago? Seriously. You know, okay, Ben Franklin wrote down something maybe about the weather. Hey, it's hot outside or it's cold outside. Okay, yeah, well, now what? So, anyway, you know, all this speculation about what the temperature was back then because of, you know, samples of ice cores and all this kind of craziness right there. How are you going to get an accurate and honest outcome for what the weather was like to what it is like now? Now, what about back when they were nothing but dinosaurs on here, you know? Okay, the dinosaurs, they were pretty big, according to what we understand. They probably, you know, had a little bit more gas than they would have. So, it'd been a lot more methane and maybe still some volcanoes erupting and all that kind of stuff. So, maybe it balanced itself out, you know, this and that. And so, that's what you get. But I'm just trying to figure out, because common sense dictates if you weren't there 41,000 years ago, or even 1,000 years ago, or even 100, or even 10 years ago, if you weren't there, how'd you know what the weather was like? And so you get all this data together. Who gathers up all this doggone data and puts it out there on the table and for the science guys to figure out? Of course, you know, if I get a bunch of information, I can obviously tell you from the information that you give me, I can come to a conclusion of what I think is going on, but it still don't mean that there ain't some flaws in the doggone conclusion, because of the data that I got might not be completely accurate, so to speak. Today you can go down in the middle of the city where all the concrete and all the cars and everything, and you can take temperatures down there, and then you can go out to the country and you can take another temperature and you'll notice there's an obvious difference. You know, it's hot some places, it's cold other places. It depends on where the sun is at any given time, or the moon, or whatever. And so, you know, we use the sun to keep us warm during the daytime, and hopefully store some of that heat energy for the nighttime and keep us warm until the sun comes up again. So, you know, they said the debate's over, but I don't even think the debate even started yet. I think there's just a whole lot of speculation and fear-mongering and all that craziness. So now we're on our way to living in mud huts, because if we don't go living in a mud hut, we're going to have some serious issues. There's going to be a lot of water where they're wanting water. There's going to be forest fires and people with the sniffles and all kinds of stuff. Not to mention climate change gives people headaches. Well, I know it gives me a headache, but not for the same reason it probably gives somebody else a headache. Anyway, let's keep rolling.
For them to predict climate change, they don't see any. The sun provides almost all of Earth's heat, and it also changes the cycles, dimming and brightening, sort of like a light bulb. For most of the last 1,000 years, when the sun turned up, temperatures rose on Earth, and when the sun dimmed, temperatures fell. But in the past few decades...
Once again, for the last 1,000 years, how would you know that? Seriously, how would you know that? It's been 1,000 years that had passed. You know how much kind of stuff could go on? How many shenanigans could happen in 1,000 years? Somebody going to tell you how the planet was hotter because the sun was brighter back then, or vice versa? This is why it gets so frustrating when it comes down to the ridiculousness of what they call climate science.
The sun's been cooling slightly, yet Earth keeps getting hotter. Solar activity can't explain today's climate change. We know carbon dioxide traps heat in the atmosphere, and the last time Earth's CO2 levels were...
How do we know that that CO2 traps carbon in the Earth's atmosphere, considering the fact that CO2 is heavier than oxygen, and there's... The higher that you get up there, the thinner the oxygen gets. So that means to say that if oxygen can't make it up there, how in the heck is carbon dioxide, which is a heavier, even carbon monoxide, which is still yet, it's like oxygen, carbon monoxide, and carbon dioxide. And the oxygen's lighter than the carbon monoxide and the carbon dioxide, because after all, the carbon monoxide has one oxygen or one carbon atom connected to the one oxygen atom, whereas CO2 has got two oxygens connected to one carbon atom. So it's still heavier than the oxygen by itself. So how's it getting up there and stopping the heat, or causing the planet to heat up? That's only common sense, man. But this, see, I don't know where folks get educated at. You know, some sort of indoctrination center or mind control facility or whatever, but they sure as heck ain't looking at the blatantly obvious, you know. Here we go, let's keep on rolling.
This high, Homo sapiens didn't exist, but maybe all this CO2 is Earth's fault. When volcanoes erupt, they release tons of the stuff, like little magma-powered Earth bursts. Geologists measured how much, and it turns out humans release about 100 times more CO2. Volcanic activity? Can't explain climate change. Some things actually cool the Earth. Cutting down more trees makes Earth's surface lighter. It reflects more light back into space. Clouds, pollutants, and aerosols in the atmosphere do the same thing. They make our atmosphere reflect...
Hold on.
Powered Earth bursts. Geologists measured how much, and it turns out humans release about 100 times more CO2. Volcanic activity... Can't explain climate change. Some things actually cool the Earth. Cutting down more trees makes Earth's surface lighter. It reflects more...
Cutting down more trees actually makes the Earth's surface lighter. Man, I don't know what science class this knucklehead went to, but I'll tell you one thing's for sure. That's just pure ridiculousness there. Because now it's going to reflect the sunlight and all that kind of jazz. Really? Got to make things cooler. So go down and cut down all the trees, people, because we need to cool the planet down. So figure out how much, how many trees you got to cut down to save us for the 12-year doomsday prediction and stuff. So we're going to cut down a bunch of trees. We're going to live in mud huts and put reflective everything on everything, so that the sun beats up into the sky instead of, might catch the sun, might catch the doggone, and maybe the sun will get a sun tan, might catch the sky on fire or something like that with all them, well, it stinks to be a bird if you're flying by all them hot mirrors reflecting the sunlight in your face. Anyway, some sunscreen 2000 ought to get that and rub it on all the birds and they'll be okay. Anyway, let's keep going.
Light back into space. Clouds, pollutants, and aerosols in the atmosphere do the same thing. They make our atmosphere reflective, so less radiation gets in. Yet even with these cooling effects getting stronger, Earth's getting warmer. But we know that greenhouse gases like CO2 and methane have skyrocketed. And when we calculate how temperatures should change based on those levels, we finally see a rise. Subtract the cooling from trees and clouds and pollution, and it matches more than a century of data. This isn't magic, it's math. These climate graphs don't show absolute temperatures, because absolute temperatures, the number on a thermometer, can be misleading. The top of a mountain will always be colder than the valley below, but if they're both a degree above normal, it gives us a hint that the larger climate might be different. And this is why we look at the anomaly. How different today's average temperature is from the average temperature somewhere in the past. The degrees above normal. But what is normal? The last month Earth's temperature was below the 20th century average was December 1984. Many of you haven't seen below average temperatures in your lifetime. July 2016 was the 379th consecutive month and the 40th.
Now, I don't know where he's getting all of his information. Maybe the doggone professor at school is toking on a bong or smoking a hookah or something like that. Maybe they're all up behind the doggone dumpster on the lunch break for the dang blunt, you know, and they're just like getting higher in a kite, eating magic mushrooms and dropping acid or something like this, because obviously they got these ideas of everything that they hadn't even they have no idea, because they weren't even there to begin with. But to teach all this kind of craziness to students who are going to go out there and spew it out there, ain't no wonder why there's so many kids ditching school to go to protest to say about, we got to save the planet from climate change. It's ridiculousness. So I don't know what kind of, you know, whiskey they've been slurping on or doggone weed they've been toking up, man. It's hard to say, man. Maybe they're all on peyote or something like that. But they sure as heck ain't on to the truth of real science, because if they was on the truth of real science, we'd already be working on making things incredibly efficient instead of wasting so much kind of stuff. Like they said, 40% of all the food made gets thrown in trash. And it ain't going to cause no methane when it hits the doggone dump or anything like that. Maybe you want to only cook what you actually know you're going to eat or something like that. Heck, I don't know. They don't want you eating cows. They don't want you eating chickens. They don't want you eating anything that took a truck to get to wherever it is, or even an industry that took to make it, because they're polluting and all this kind of stuff. Well, the rich keep on getting richer because they own the coal factories and they own the electric plants and all that kind of stuff. They own the mines, and yeah, they keep on making money. So yeah, you're gonna get those folks out there gonna fight like heck to say, oh, climate change ain't real. Which I don't know what. How do you say there ain't no such thing as a climate change? And one day it's raining, next day it ain't raining. That's a climate change, but it ain't got nothing to do with man-made. I didn't make it rain. Thus, I got out there and did my rain dance, and it worked or something like that. The God smiled on me and put some water in my pond or something like that. But you don't have to be sitting around smoking a blunt or dropping acid or toking on a hookah inhaling a bong or taking some sort of uppers or downers or sidewaysers or crookeders or, that kind of stuff, snorting magic mushrooms and eating cocaine and all that kind of crap. You don't got to do all that to understand this is like stupid. This ain't no common sense. listen to all these people talking about all the reasons why, oh, maybe the sun's heating it up, but possibly it's not, because the volcanoes could be cooling it down. Or no, if you cut down the trees, they'll sure as heck reflect the sunlight, because there won't be no trees. I got news for those folks. We got a symbiotic relationship with the plant life on this world that we live in. We breathe out their food, and then they give us back fresh oxygen so we can continue to breathe. But nonetheless, it doesn't matter, you know, because these folks, they got the debate figured out. It's already sorted. You're going to live in a mud hut. You're not going to drive a car, but they will, because they're the elite. They got to ensure that somebody's around to enforce the rules on you. So you're going to live in a skyscraper made out of mud and straw and sticks. Stinks to be the guy at the bottom when the structural integrity fails because they didn't practice basic physics and science. But nonetheless, you're already, beyond 6 feet under. If it's a 10-story building, you're already going to meet your maker, you know, off into the afterworld, that kind of stuff, when the building collapsed from the ridiculousness of it. So we're going to have to stop making steel. We're going to have to stop making, sodas with, little bubbly things in there, or, you know, champagnes for the wedding night and all that kind of stuff. We're going to stop making all that kind of stuff because we got to get rid of that nasty old CO2 that's causing everybody problems, and you're going to have to run around with a bag on your face and try to catch as much CO2 when you breathe out. So, sucks to be the guy pulling the rickshaw with 40 passengers, because you're going to be panting all to get out, and they're going to be holding a bag over your face, try to catch some of that CO2 before, you know, you pass out or so whatever. So, you got to watch for the signs of, hyperventilation and somebody getting a little bit dizzy and that kind of stuff. And because if he's getting ready to go down and he's already halfway up the hill, guess what? You're going back down, starting all over from the beginning. You're not going to make it up top of that hill if that man passes out, you know? So maybe y'all just get out and walk yourself up the hill and call it a day. Might be safer than that, unless you got, some sort of seat belts and airbag system. Well, you can't have an airbag if it's got a propellant in it, but you could have, some sort of roll cage for if the rickshaw goes down the ravine and off to the cliff, to the sharp rocks below, that maybe you might survive if you got your little buddy helmet on. We're just trying to make sure that everybody stays safe, right? That's the whole thing. You know, they talk about depopulation, but they don't let it naturally occur because, you know, we got to make sure everybody's safe and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, so, you know, moving right along, I don't know where these folks get all their doggone information, but they got to have some sort of something going on, man. You know, you sit around and you take a couple big old snorts off a big jug of whiskey or something like that, you know, which you ain't going to be able to make any more unless you do like the old just regular fermentation kind of thing, but, you can't have a steel out there. And, either way, they take a couple snorts off the jug and take a couple of hits off the hookah or the bong, whatever. Maybe take a deep draw off a blunt and drop some acid, and then they start talking about science. That's how modern science is. That's what they do. I mean, especially if you're an astrophysicist, you can talk about the stars where you ain't never been before. You could say, yeah, man, because of that color right there, I think that doggone planet over there, it's got a lot of CO2 on it. Or that planet over there, it's got a lot of helium. It'd be kind of fun to go to helium world, because you'd be talking like that kind of craziness, and people, you'd be laughing and having a good old time, and your brain would be a little floaty or whatever. You know, it's just that, I'm just saying, just trying to point these things out because nobody else is. So with that said, I just got to try to figure out what's on these people's mind. You know, if there really is a problem out there, we got to get climate under control, then maybe the mud hut scenario is where we're going to have to go, because, that's the only one that's logical. Shut your car off, shut your AC off, shut all your lights off, and shut the power plants down, including the nuclear one. Of course, somebody got to keep that running for a little while, because they say that fuel's got to stay cool. If it doesn't, well, just get a bunch of people over there and throw buckets of cool water on the nuclear rods every so often, and watch out for any signs of some sort of explosion or something like that, which I'm sure would be blatantly obvious for those that are pretty far away, but, you know, probably be instantaneous for the guys or gals that are up there close enough to be throwing on with buckets of water. But, you know, it don't give up yet. Don't lose faith. Don't lose hope and all that kind of stuff. We get this kind of deal. You know, while they're all sitting around huffing paint fumes and talking about science and doomsday, we're all out here trying to get some common sense on the table so that maybe some people really seriously get serious about if they want to save the environment. We can do it. We got the technology. We can re-engineer things to make them work better. So you ain't wasting so much fuel. We can even recycle, you know, all kinds of things like last year's fertilizer and so on. Ask me how and I'll tell you. I paid attention in science class, but, you know, it was back in the day when, you know, they had real scientists and not these weird indoctrinating doomsday / agenda-driven whatever kind of ist that they had behind their name and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, hey. Let's just keep rolling here.
July in a row of above average temperatures. Yet you probably heard more news lately about breaking Olympic records than climate records. Are we really just used to this? In 1995, biologist Daniel Pauly coined the idea of shifting baselines. The idea that we evaluate change very differently depending on what we're comparing to. Today, about 500,000 bison live in North America, a remarkable recovery from the late 19th century. But compared to the 20 to 30 million that roamed the plains before 1600, our bison baseline suddenly paints a very different picture. We know how hot Earth has been over the past century and a half. We have the data. Scientists understand that Earth's climate is a complex puzzle whose pieces affect one another in many ways.
Well, that's probably one of the only doggone things that it said was after actually halfway common sense about, you know, how nature is interacting with the climate, you know. So, obviously, you know, you got different temperatures in different areas and different things will affect. So if you're jacking with the weather on this side, you can change something on that side. You don't have to be free base and clear sail to understand that if you tamper with nature, nature's going to get a little bit rowdy on you. And if nature's already been toking on the hookah, so to speak, then maybe nature's going to be up a little bit rowdy, too. So, you know, when Mother Nature jumps down there with the nunchucks and, you know, the kung fu fighting theme in the background and starts jap-slapping you back into the Stone Age, well, I guess you're going to get the point across that maybe you ought not mess with Mother Nature because Mother Nature don't play around. And if she's already happy on the hookah, then, hey, what you got? You're in it. You're in it. You better be in it to win it. That's what you better be, because you know, nature don't play around. Nature recycles everything, including you. So if you start it, if you start some, there probably more assuredly is going to be some, and nature's going to mess you up. But as far as this whole thing, you driving your car to work's causing nature to get angry. Look, nature want to get angry. Nature sort you out in a hurry, but it ain't got nothing to do with your car. You know, there's more CO2 coming up out them doggone volcanoes, CO2, carbon monoxide, all kinds of noxious gases or whatever, and even up out of the doggone ground. You know, when those plants and stuff, they rot up underneath the ponds, and next thing you know, the pond's flipping over, and everybody's freaking out thinking it's the apocalypse. That's because all that methane and CO2 that was produced by the rotting and the fermenting of all that biological waste up underneath the mud built a big old gas pocket, and eventually the gas pocket overwhelmed the pond, and it rolled over, and basically all the fish died in there from lack of oxygen, and it looks like heck upside there, and you think the doggone apocalypse just occurred. There's a lot of places in this world where people lived at bases of volcanoes and couldn't figure out why it is that suddenly in the middle of the night this lake burped and then everybody in the neighborhood's dead because they couldn't breathe. Well, that's, you know, that's nature. You got to learn these things. You know, CO2 ponds up in low-lying areas. So if you got that kind of common sense, you'll build your house in a respective manner. You know, you work in harmony with nature. Nature won't jab slap you back into the ice age or whatever, like that kind of stuff. But it, you know, as far as man-made climate change, you think you got a high opinion of yourself. I'll tell you what, nature don't play around. You think you're tougher than nature? Nature's like some sort of MMA fighter when you get all up in there thinking you got what it takes because you've been out on the street boxing with old Joe down the street. You know, you think you got it, but then that doggone nature just kind of jacks your jaw when you roll up in there and, you know, curb stomps you into oblivion. You don't play around with nature. Nature won't play around with you. You want to be peaceful, nature be loving. But if you want to be ignorant, then, you know, nature will do what nature does. And sometimes nature gets rowdy on its own. You know, there's changes that goes on. You know, cycles and everything. But these folks out here, I swear, they just can't get their act together. And what they're teaching kids in school is more political than anything else. Kind of indoctrination, political ideology. I want you to be a communist or a Marxist. This is what Karl Marx thought. Okay. Well, I think that too now. Give me a picket sign. I'll be out there. We'll sort it out. Instead of taking that education and start learning how to make things more efficiently to be better, that's what they do, man. That's what they do. And then if you don't know what the facts are, you just make it up as you go. That's what science has become. That's why mad science is so important, because mad science is real science, and the mainstream science has been some sort of indoctrinating propagandist machine that is basically doing, you know, nothing for further in humanity, except for maybe making some patents for a few companies that want to give them some money and that kind of stuff. But hey, we'll get to that too. They're saying, oh, I ain't making no money. I'm a scientist. I ain't making no money. Yeah, right. Yeah, I believe that. Anyway, let's keep on rolling.
They put those pieces together to recreate that history, to find a cause. The picture is clear. Let's take a long, hard look at it. Stay curious. Hey guys, this is not a green screen. I'm in Switzerland. Hope you enjoyed this week's video.
After all that, that man did not come to a cause for why the planet is supposedly heating up. After all that. So, making up all these facts and basically spewing out propaganda of what this guy said, what that science guy, we got all this data. Yeah, I want to see the data. I want to know who collected the data. I want to reopen the debate that they say is completely over. And I want to get down to the facts. If you say that there's climate change and climate disruption and global warming out there, then you need to bring your happy booty up to the table and let's sit down and let's work this thing out. Because if you think that fossil fuels are problems, then why not take all the solutions that have been readily available and talk about some of the guys and gals that got killed out there trying to bring more efficient ways of doing things to the table, or even better, health cures and stuff like that, natural stuff. Talk about all them doctors that talked about natural medicine coming up missing, and all the inventors of different types of technologies that come up dead or suicided or, you know, disappeared, abducted by aliens and probed into oblivion. Yeah, you just talk about some of that right there. But it's all conspiracy, man. You're a nutcase because you say free energy. I'll tell you that. You think I'm wrong? Get on YouTube. Take a peek, man. YouTube promotes idiocy. YouTube promotes lies. YouTube promotes freaking propaganda, ideologies, all kinds of. YouTube promotes, and Google, all of these dang new deals out there to promote everything but solutions. They ain't out there talking about how to fix things. They're out there complaining about what they think is wrong and trying to tell you what they're going to do to you to fix it. You're going to live in a mud hut. You ain't going to ride around the bus. You ain't going to ride around the car. You're not going to drive a motorcycle. You're never flying in a plane. And you're just going to do what you do, and that's all you get. You're going to head out there and eat some dang berries and tree bark and, you know, live with the skeeters and the ticks and the fleas and all that kind of stuff. You know, go back to living like they said you came from a monkey. You said you actually at one point was probably like a fish or a squiggly thing, and then a fish, and then whatever. And eventually you sprouted legs and you climbed up the tree, become a monkey, start eating bananas. And then you got a little bit of brains in you, and you started making electricity and burning coal and all kinds of stuff. The next thing you know, now you're responsible for destroying the planet, because you're the one that's causing the climate change from the CO2 emissions coming out of your car, and because you turned your light bulb on. So that's a pretty far stretch from the squiggly thing all the way to Mr. El Destructo and Mrs. El Destructo out there destroying the doggone planet. So while you're all at home freebasing Clearasil, they're up there snorting crack and cocaine and smoking meth and freebasing everything that they can get their hands on. Somebody's toking on a hookah in the White House. Somebody's sucking on a bong in Congress. You know, not to mention what the parliament guys are dropping acid and magic mushrooms on a regular basis. They're all stoned out their doggone gourd because they're buying every lie told by these ridiculous people out there who never paid attention in science class and turn around and repeating everything that they heard from somebody else. Pete repeats in the boat and Pete falls out. Who's left? All right, we're not getting anything done. We're getting ridiculousness. That's what we're getting. We're getting pure and utter ridiculousness. And I'm going to tell you one thing for sure. I ain't going to go live in no doggone mud hut. And if I have to prove a point, I'll go outside and start a tire fire. I don't care. Because I know the real science. And this ridiculousness that they're trying to pull off on people is really getting under my skin, getting on my nerves. I've been hearing about this forever and a day. This lady here on CNN, listen, this is pretty funny here, man. This lady, I tell you what, she's going to laugh at you. All right? She's going to tell you how dumb you are. Ah! Let's hear this.
I've seen it. I've read some of it, and it's fine. Yeah, I don't believe it. No, I don't believe it.
All right, that's President Trump not believing a dire report from 13 federal agencies in his own administration, aided by 300 leading scientists, all of which predict that climate change will cause environmental and economic devastation in America by the end of this century. Joining us now is one of the scientists who helped write that report, Catherine Hayhoe. She's the director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University.
Hold on, pause for a second. Catherine Hayhoe. I want you to think about this for a second. Catherine Hayhoe. This is just kind of ironic, because every time they're out there doggone protest, it's like, hey ho, gotta go, gotta deliver these toys, you know. No, that ain't it. It's like, hey ho, something like that. Anyway, Trump has gotta go. Yeah, that's it. Hey ho, Trump has gotta go. Hee haw. Something about his mom. I don't know, but I just thought that was weird, that name, the science lady, Catherine Hey Ho. That's pretty funny.
City. Catherine, great to have you with us, and we're so glad that you can help us sift through all this, because it's more than 1,000 pages, and so we need your help boiling it down. But it just gets more and more disturbing the more you dive into it. Here are some of the findings. Higher temperatures are already happening. They will increase deaths. Food and waterborne illnesses will spread. Wildfires, as we've just seen so painfully in California, will increase. Floods, as we've just seen after hurricanes, will be more frequent. Asthma. And
pause. Man, let's rewind that just a second. Higher temperatures will increase deaths. Food and waterborne illnesses, diseases will spread. Wildfires, increased floods will be more frequent. Huh. Well, that's pretty drastic, man. So if it gets hot out there, more people are going to die. And on the inverse, if it gets more cold, more people are going to die. So if you're living in a mud hut and it's hot or cold, you're probably going to die. Food and waterborne illnesses are probably due to poor sanitation and people dumping things where they should not go and killing off the natural bacteria. It's like, if you actually think about it, if you got antibacterial soap everywhere on the planet and hand cleaners and all that kind of stuff, what do you think that does when you wash it down the drain? Well, it kills off natural bacteria that would cause problems where now you might get a E. coli virus that wouldn't normally grow in a certain area that is growing because it's been polluted by, you know, basically the equivalence of poison for those particular bacteria that are necessary in nature in order to balance everything out. So the wildfires, hey, when you're toking on the bong or smoking the blunt, don't be dropping your doggone roach and the doggone thistles out there, and you probably won't start no fires. Cars backfiring, or maybe catalytic converters, somebody driving up on the dry grass. There's all kinds of things, even including lightning. You know, nature starts a few fires now and then. Plus, there's even some conspiracies out there about how government's actually starting fires in order to be able to do things. You know, maybe you can buy some land up cheaper if you burn everybody out of there. It's not the first time in history somebody's tried some ridiculousness like that. But anyway, stop freebasing Clearasil and get your act together, because we got to live in some mud huts.
Wildfires, as we've just seen so painfully in California, will increase. Floods, as we've just seen after hurricanes, will be more frequent. Asthma and allergies will be worse. Crop production.
Pause. Asthma and allergies being worse might just have something to do with the poor air quality in the general vicinity where everybody's living. You know, they got these little air fresheners that every once in a while you walk by, you got to be careful because they'll spray you in your eyeballs, but they go off every so often and spray a scent in your room, and, you know, that carcinogen getting down inside your lungs probably not helping things out. Plus, all the chemistry that you use in your house probably ain't a good idea as well. Make sure you always read the warning labels of everything. And you're burning little scenty candles in there and wondering why you can't breathe half the time. I had one of them about choke me out of the house. But nonetheless, all kinds of different things, possibilities, even little bitty microscopic pieces of rubber on the tires as you're standing next to the roadway and all these tires are grinding across that asphalt across the road there and just kicking up little microscopic particles of rubber. And not to mention all the other chemistry that, you know, might have to be involved in your schools or everywhere else. So we don't never really get down to the truth of what's actually causing it. We just make a lot of stuff up. It's all climate change because of the, asthma and allergies being worse now because the, whatever. And the crop productions will decline due to higher temperatures, drought, and flooding and all that kind of stuff. Seafood industry predicts the loss to lose 230 million by the end of the century. Who makes this stuff up, man? It must be an astrophysicist involved in this, because it's like that quantum physics stuff. But quantum physics is for when you can't figure it out, you can just make it up, because everything's possible in quantum physics.
Will decline because of high temperatures and drought. Seafood industry predicted to lose 230 million by the end of the century. It's all so dire. What are we missing? What do you think the headline from this report is?
What we're missing is the fact that climate is already changing and it's affecting us today in the places where we live. It's no longer a future issue. Today, in some places in coastal Florida, property prices have already dropped 7% along the coast compared to just inland. Wherever we live, whether we're subject to wildfire, hurricanes, heavy precipitation, flooding, heat waves, we are already experiencing the impacts today.
And so when you hear President Trump say, I don't believe it, I know that, I mean, you've said something funny previously where it's like not believing in gravity. If climate change doesn't care if you believe in it or not. It's still happening. But what does it mean for the rest of us that he doesn't believe in it? Could some of this stuff be staved off if our leader believed in it?
Carbon emissions are kind of like smoking. The best time to stop is now. If we can't stop now, then as soon as possible. So every year that continues without serious action to reduce and eventually eliminate our carbon emissions is another year of guaranteed impacts further down the road.
And so, I mean, since you're so steeped in this material, when you hear the president say he doesn't believe it, how does that make you feel?
It makes me feel frustrated because, again, you can say I don't believe in gravity, but if you step off the cliff, you're going down. So we can say I don't believe climate is changing, but it's based on science that's over 150 years old. And if we're making decisions that don't just affect us, but that affect hundreds of millions of people based on flawed or faulty information,
Well, based on flawed or faulty information, they're willing to basically push in a lot of laws that are going to affect a lot of people, a lot of jobs and all that kind of stuff, and actually get you to the point where you got to live in a mud hut and not be able to drive to work and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, this is like the pot calling the kettle black kind of thing right here. It's supposedly a scientist. So let's listen. This is the smart one here. I'm telling you that.
The result is not going to be good.
You know what the skeptics say. I'm sure you've heard it a million times. They think that all of you scientists are self-interested. You're doing this because you're bankrolled by other people. That some of your predictions in the past haven't come true. Therefore, you're, I guess, delegitimized. Here are, just yesterday, what some of the skeptics said. Listen to this.
A lot of these scientists are driven by the money that they receive. The report is nothing more than a rehash of age-old 10 to 20-year assumptions made by scientists that get paid to further the politics of global warming.
We have created a climate change industrial complex in this country with billions and billions and billions of dollars at stake. A lot of people are getting really, really, really rich off the climate change issue.
Catherine, are you just rolling in the dough? Is that why you're doing this? You're just cashing in?
Rolling on the floor laughing is more like it. I got paid $0 to write this report. My salary would have been exactly the same if I had or hadn't. And if I were studying astrophysics like I used to, I'd probably get exactly the same salary as well. The reality is, I've found, is that people often accuse us of doing what they would do themselves in our position. If we just cast our eye down the richest corporations in the entire world on Wikipedia's list, the vast majority of those owe their wealth to fossil fuels, so therefore they have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo as long as possible.
Catherine, I think that it's hard even for regular people, even people who aren't skeptics, to know what to believe, because it's also overwhelming. It's also, it makes people feel powerless, so it's easy to turn away from this. What will happen? I mean, what do you want people to know in terms of, if we do nothing by 2050, say, what will our lives look like?
The most important thing, I think, to know is that our choices matter. A certain amount of impacts are inevitable because of what we've done before. It's as if we've been smoking a pack of cigarettes a day for several decades. But the most serious and dangerous impacts are not here yet, and they can be avoided. How? By acting. What's the first step? The first step is actually to talk about it. Because studies have shown that 3/4 of Americans
Pause. What you mean talk about it? I thought the debate's over. You want to tell everybody a bunch of lies, and then you want them to talk about it. So then whenever they point out your lies and your ridiculousness and your hypocrisy riding around in the bus or the airplane, it don't matter whether it's coach or first class, you're still flying in the same doggone airplane. You just get to sit in a fancier seat if you got more money. That's a whole dang deal right there. And every bit of it's all about money. So I'm sure this lady ain't poor either, but nonetheless, regardless, not everyone out there is smart enough to monopolize like Al Gore and be able to make millions and billions of dollars by scaring everybody into doomsday. And they already moved it up to 2050, man. That's what I thought we had only to 2020 by some folks' standard, and maybe 10 or 12 years if you're lucky by the other standard. So doomsday keeps moving on down the road. Somebody keeps on getting rich. Somebody keeps on fighting back and forth over it. We're going to get down to the facts of the matter. We're going to have to pay attention to common sense and real science and real mechanics and real physics, not all this. And if you happen to hear that back there, she did mention that she studied astrophysicists, so she studied the stars, man. She could tell you about them stars. Yeah, okay, and all these different planets are supposedly heating up out there, too. Well, I wonder what that has to do with. We'll just have to figure it out, man. Why don't we build our spaceship and we'll just roll on up there and just check it out. But we're going to have to build our spaceship that is, all electric or something like that, so that it's environmentally friendly. Never mind that it's going to take a process to get those batteries made and all that kind of stuff that might not be environmentally friendly. However, we could just, like I said earlier, get a bunch of lemons and some different types of metals and make us batteries out of some citrus fruits and stuff like that, you know, maybe some grapefruits or something, and we'll power our grapefruit doggone spaceship out there and take some actual measurements ourselves. I mean, these folks, they've never been there, but they keep talking about how they know what's going on there. So that's, you know, it's pretty impressive, right?
Somebody else talk about it more than once or twice a year. I'm not saying we have to dive deep into the science, but this report, the National Climate Assessment, offers a great opportunity for us to say, hey, I live in the Northeast, the Midwest, the Southwest, Texas, Florida, Louisiana, and here's what's already happening in the places where we live. Here's why it matters to us personally, not the polar bears, not future generations, but us. And then it's important to talk about what we can do about it. The fact that in Texas, we have 25,000 jobs in the wind energy industry already. The fact that the coal mining museum in Kentucky put solar panels on the roof. The fact that our economy can continue to grow and thrive as we transition to clean energy.
Catherine Hayhoe, it is so helpful to hear that it is not hopeless. Thank you very much for sharing your science with us.
Yeah,
thank you for having me.
Thanks for sharing that.
I love the idea of
like
a bunch of billionaire scientists like rolling around in cash at some exclusive club somewhere for studying climate change.
I know. I mean, when she actually could break it down for you after she got $1 million grant to do research. At the end of it, after paying facility fees, administration fees, she got $2,000.
Fascinating to hear that perspective.
$1 million grant. That's probably a good that's probably a good reason why you want to talk about certain things in a certain way, so that you can ensure that you get that doggone grant. Anyway, let's see. I don't know where else we went here. I think we done covered just about every base of ridiculousness under the sun. So, let me see. Make sure I got them all. I think I did. Yeah, I think we done covered everything. But, hey. La, 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 la. Let me see this. I think I don't remember if I did this or not.
Hi, it's Mr. Anderson, and this is AP Environmental Sciences, Video 28. It's on renewable energy. We really live in a society that's driven and governed by fossil fuels. The whole infrastructure is built on fossil fuels, but they have problems. They're non-renewable, so they're finite, will run out, and they're polluting the atmosphere, especially with carbon dioxide that's leading to global warming. And so we have to reduce the amount of energy that we're using, but we also have to move towards more renewable forms of energy. And so in this video, we'll talk about the six following categories. But just because it's renewable doesn't mean it's sustainable. So wood, for example, is a wonderful form of renewable biomass energy, but if you use too much of it, it leads to deforestation. Or hydroelectric power is great, but can change the natural flow of a river, can change that whole ecosystem. And so we have to make sure that our energy sources are not only renewable, but sustainable. So we'll start by talking about biomass, one of the most ancient forms. We'll talk about solid forms, wood and charcoal, and then we'll talk about more recent forms, biodiesel and ethanol. We'll then talk about small-scale hydroelectric power in the form of waves and tides. We'll then talk about all the different types of solar systems, both passive and active, and then thermal heating systems and photovoltaics, those that actually convert the energy of the sun directly into electricity. We'll then talk about geothermal electricity-generating forms of energy, and then heat pumps that can be used residentially. We'll then talk about wind power and wind turbines. We'll then talk about hydrogen in the future as a way we could harness that power in fuel cells, but the big problem is going to be the infrastructure itself. In other words, how do we store this energy, and how do we move it where it needs to go? Because if we're looking at fossil fuels, we can get consistent energy, but the solar energy and the wind energy is not always going to be consistent. So let's look at the size difference between renewable and non-renewable. If this sphere represents the amount of energy that we consume on our planet every year, 16 terawatts of energy, then each of these spheres represents the potential energy that we can find in both non-renewable and renewable resources. The one that dwarfs everything else is going to be the sun. So the potential energy found within the sun is huge. But we have a lot of energy in coal, uranium, oil, and natural gas. The problem with all of these on the right side is that they're non-renewable. We will run out of these. Now, if we look at how much are we using, the global energy consumption, as I mentioned earlier, is almost on all non-renewables. And so it seems puzzling that we have a lot more energy potential on the left side, but we're using energy reserves that are eventually going to run away. Well, it all comes down to economics, or energy returned over energy invested. And this is...
Let's pause here for a second, because they keep talking about everything's going to run out. They ain't going to run out of nothing. It ain't possible to run out of anything. That's the whole doggone thing. You know, I said, somebody one time said, you know, I kept saying, why somebody could actually, you know, say that we're going to run out of water to drink. And then somebody said, well, that's fresh water, stupid. What? Fresh water? I guess they ain't never heard of desalination plants and anything like that. They ain't never really paid attention to how nature does it. So how you gonna, you might die of thirst because you didn't pay attention in science class. But, you know, outside of that, every single thing that you think you got rid of, whether you burned it or not, it just changed its molecular structure. The chemistry's still there. All that chemistry gets mixed back into the system, and it makes more of what you had before. So, you know, you keep thinking you're going to run out of stuff. Now, granted, you know, you cut down a lot of trees in a certain area, then you're going to change that environmental area for that, maybe even cause some, you know, extinction events as far as animals that aren't going to be able to survive because you just took away their habitat. So that's something that you'd have to use common sense on. But nonetheless, you turn that firewood into, or you turn that wood into firewood, or maybe you build some 2x4s and 5x9s and 10x12s and all that kind of stuff, and you build you a house out of it, and eventually nature rots that house and the bugs eat it, like the termites and all that, and it gets put back into the system again. So nothing that you made is ever going to last. They try to say plastic will last in the dump for, you know, hundreds if not thousands of years and so on down the line. Ugh. Never mind, I ain't even going to go down that road, because it's like talking to the wall. It's arguing to the fence. It's not going to make any difference. Nature recycles everything, including you. You're going to be recycled. That's unfortunate, because you might be a nice person. But eventually you're going to be mixed back into the system, and somebody's going to be digging up molecules that maybe once might have been you, and they might be calling it fossil fuel. Because everything out there is a doggone fossil fuel. There ain't no such thing as fossil fuel. You got grass clippings, you got wood, you got different types of duckweed, watermill, all different types of grass plants and weeds and everything basically made out of carbon. Carbon-based life form basically turns into be crude oil if it falls under the right circumstances of heat and pressure and chemistry and so on down the line. But when you burn that firewood, you think you got rid of it. You didn't. All you did was change the chemistry and the molecular structure of it, and basically made different types of materials and such that nature is just going to recycle and put back into other things. You know, nitrogens and all different types of other chemistry that is basically the leftover byproducts of burning firewood and such. So, you know, the real deal, people don't get taught that in school. They don't get taught that they are quite literally a renewable energy source. And so, you know, it's the doom and gloom that makes the money. So this lady laughing in everybody's faces, maybe she wasn't wise enough to do what Al Gore did and write a book about it or whatever. But nonetheless, she still got a huge grant, so that's job security. Plus, from what I understand, she got a couple $1,000s out of it after paying all the bills for, you know, the deal. So that's job security anyway. And so why would you want to buck the system and tell everybody, oh, climate change is a hockahooey? Because now they're going to look at you like you've been eating magic mushrooms or dropping acid, because they already been indoctrinated and programmed in school and in the colleges to believe the propaganda and the indoctrination to the extent that now they go out there to be disciples and preachers of the propaganda and go out there and try to tell you what you got to change in your life in order to make their life better and to ensure that the future of humanity survives. Well, if you do a little bit of, you know, real science, of real mechanics, of real physics, then you can figure out that it's not that doggone hard to literally make things run efficiently, and then we can actually recycle all kinds of things, even last year's fertilizer, if you understand what I've been trying to say for everybody, that, you know, when all that nutrients runs off down into the pond, you just made more fertilizer. So, hey, you know, cows are making fertilizers, chickens making fertilizers, you're making fertilizers, you're making methane, they're making methane. It's a gaseous world. Everybody's out there producing all kinds of different byproducts, and every one of these byproducts gets recycled back into the system. Doesn't matter what you put into the doggone system, eventually nature will break it down without a doubt. And if you think you're, you know, like Joe Superman or woman, and you can outdo nature, well, more power to you. But you find out that probably 50 to 100 years down the line, they'll probably be still trying to pull the same type of shenanigans. Anything they can do to scare people into being subservient and essentially a slave. That's it.
This is a term that I'll keep coming back to. So if we look at a 1-to-1 ratio, that would mean we're investing $1 in this form of energy and we're getting $1 back. So we could call that the break even. And we don't even look at energy sources until they become around a 3-to-1 ratio of we're investing $1, we're getting $3 back. What do you think coal is? Well, if we look at coal, it's about an 80-to-1. It's a very small amount of money that's invested in coal mining and coal production compared to the amount of energy that we get back. Now, if we look at something in the U.S. like corn ethanol, it's a 1.3-to-1. So you can see there's no economic incentive for us to start using ethanol until this ratio becomes more compatible with that of the non-renewables. So let's start with biomass. Wood is one of the most ancient forms of biomass, and so we use it in Montana. We use it all.
Just keep in mind the non-renewable thing is a hoax. It's a lie. There is no such thing as a non-renewable. Everything that has been here is here, will be here thousands, if not millions of years after. Everything that was on this rock is still on this rock. It's just in some different form. It's all mixed into the chemistry. And now let's go into firewood.
All across the northern latitudes, cut down some old trees, put them in a wood-burning stove, and you can heat your house. Now, if we look at the energy returned over energy invested, it's a 25-to-1 ratio. This is going to be the highest ratio that I'll show you of any of the renewables. And so why isn't this the perfect form? Well, it leads to other problems. It leads to pollution and can lead to deforestation. So if you're using this cooking, you're going to get a huge amount of soot that's coming off of it. And that's not usually how it's used, especially in developing countries. They'll make that wood into charcoal. So you cover it up and then you heat it up anaerobically. You get charcoal, which has a lot more potential energy, but also a lot more problem. And so as you use charcoal, we can have increases in carbon monoxide. It's going to be dirty and also can lead to deforestation. So in Haiti, so this is Haiti on the left side, they have a huge amount of deforestation. It used to be, I think, 60% of Haiti was covered in trees, and now it's something like 2%. And they're sneaking into the adjacent Dominican Republic to take charcoal back to where they are. And so there are huge problems, again, not sustainable. If we look at biomass, two big areas is biodiesel. So we're taking things like canola and canola oil or soybean oil, and we're refining it to make a diesel. If we look at the energy return to energy invested, it's a very small number. If we're looking at ethanol, so corn ethanol, we're fermenting the sugars inside it to make ethanol. It's like drinking alcohol, but we can eventually combust it. If we're looking at corn, again, it's a 1.3-to-1 ratio. If we were to go to sugarcane in the U.S., it's going to be a 3-to-1 ratio, but in Brazil, it's going to be up to an 8-to-1 ratio. So it depends on what our energy source is and where it's actually being grown can change the amount of energy we get back. I talked about hydroelectric power on a large scale in a separate video. I'll put a link to that here. But hydroelectric power can have a huge return on our investment. If we're looking at small-scale hydroelectric, waves over time, as the wind blows over the surface of the water, we generate these waves. We can harness some of that. We can have a 15-to-1 ratio. If we're looking at tidal energy, as the tide comes in and out, we can harness that energy with a similar kind of a ratio. Again, it doesn't scale as large as large-scale hydroelectric. If we're looking at solar energy, we've got passive energy. That's when we're just letting light in, especially during the winter, and we're collecting it. So this would be an example of a passive heating system where we have all of the windows on the south-facing side of the house and then a huge amount of insulation to hold that thermal heat on the inside. If we're talking about more active systems, so this would be a thermal heating system where we're heating up water and we're using it to heat our house. It's got a really low efficiency or low return on investment. If we're looking at photovoltaics, converting the energy right into electricity, there's been huge growth in this technology. The ratio is closer to 7-to-1. And if we're looking at these giant concentrating power plants where we condense all of that energy on one...
I'm just saying, nature didn't make the crack baby. The crackhead and the chemist made the crack baby. So, you know, this is why this drives me insane, because you throw some solutions out there on the table, people debunk the solutions, other people throw more solutions on the table, people come on to debunk it and all this kind of stuff. Never mind the fact that if you shoot for incredible efficiency and be respectful to nature, you can actually get what you need and still be able to live comfortably and not destroy the world that you live in. So that's common sense, but we ain't got no common sense in the world of the day. So let's finish out what this guy said.
Point to heat up water and then generate electricity through steam, we can get a higher ratio. There's a huge amount of potential for solar energy in the future. If we're looking at geothermal, this is energy from within the earth. So in Iceland, for example, they've gone 100% renewables. A lot of that's hydroelectric, but they're also using geothermal power. As you heat up that material underneath the earth, it's generating electricity as it flows through turbines. Get a huge ratio on that. And then we can use a heat pump in your own house where we're pumping fluids or air down into the earth where it's being heated during the winter, and it returns some of that energy to us. And even during the summer, it can pump back some of the cool air underneath the earth. And then we can use wind. Wind has probably the greatest potential at this point right now, especially these offshore wind turbines. And so they're massive. If we look at the size of this person here compared to the turbine and the generator, we can get a huge amount of return, 18-to-1 ratio. And then as we look to the future, a lot of people say the future is in hydrogen. So if we can separate water and into hydrogen and oxygen, and then we have them on either side of an electrolyte, we can generate electricity as they flow together, generating just water as a byproduct. And so this is a bus that's running just on hydrogen fuel. The ratio is incredibly small now. It's less than that break-even point, but it could be in the future that we can get some way to harness the power of algae or harness the power of plants to do the breaking of the hydrogen and oxygen apart for us. It could be something that we look at in the future. But again, the major constraints at this point is that we have the whole infrastructure built on fossil fuels, the movement, the storage of the material. And so what we have to do is move towards an area of maybe a smart grid where we're figuring out where is energy being produced? How do we move it to where it needs to go? It's not only power lines, but it's also harnessing the power of metering and the internet to figure out where the energy is and where it has to go. And so again, did you learn the following? Could you pause the video at this point and fill in all the blanks? If you can't, I'll try to do it for you. So renewable energy, we've got solid and liquid. This would be like biodiesel and ethanol. Hydroelectric small scale could be the winds and the tides. We've got passive solar, and then we have active solar heating, water systems, and then the photovoltaics. We've got geothermal heat pumps, and then we've got hydrogen in fuel cells. Wind and turbines are a huge way that we can generate energy, but it all comes down to storage of that energy and then moving it where it needs to go, and I hope that was helpful.
Yeah, it was helpful, man. Helpful. I got a headache. Anyway, so the solutions are available. You take all these different things. You go back to my Free Thinkers video, which basically that project is gone thanks to some vandals and that kind of jazz. But nonetheless, Either way, you take you let nature do what nature does, and you monopolize on that expended energy out there, and then you use all this in the right areas at the right places, and you have more energy than you could ever use in a trillion lifetimes. But nonetheless, good news is my new lab is just about complete. I'm starting to get closer and closer to where I can actually start putting YouTube videos back out again and showing you guys and gals out there the real deal, the truth about free energy. You know, if you look up on that website out there, you'll find a t-shirt that I printed out there. I'll post another picture link on there. Make you a shirt up there, because if you know, mad science is the key to truth about free energy. Ask me why. And that's what I've been trying to get people to do. Ask me why. Open up a dialogue. And so we can take all these years of science and knowledge and research and take and put them in to the right place at the right time and get the world moved towards. We don't have to give up on technology. All we got to do is be a little bit more respectful and use it more efficiently. So with that said, I done said everything I can say. Don't be a crack baby. You know, look, just get out there, tell these people to stop trying to freebase Clearasil and doping up and all this kind of crazy stuff. You might as well just tell these people not to waste their time or money going to college, because they sure as heck ain't learned nothing. If they have, they sure as heck ain't talking about it, because they're preaching craziness. Anyway, you've been listening to Mad Science. If you like this show, share it. If you don't, then, hey, see you next time. I'll try better.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
It was that ant that stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss. They're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this? You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.